We can get committee members and guests to have a seat. There's a quorum present, and I would like to get Representative Norton. Would you make a motion to approve the minutes for Wednesday, March 25th and Thursday, March 26th?
I would indeed.
Great. Representative Norton moves approval of the minutes for March 25th and 26th, 2009. Any discussion from members? Hearing none, those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 25th and 26th are approved. We're going to start out with House File 981, Representative Bly. Morning, Representative Bly. How are you today?
Good.
Good. Representative Newton, wondering if you'd be willing to move Representative Bly's bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 981 for possible inclusion in the Commerce Bill.
Actually, we're going to move it to the K-12 education. Oh, referred to finance with a recommended, further recommendation, we referred to K-12 finance. Yes. Representative Bly, to your bill.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here to talk about an important initiative. I looked over the brief that Mr. Kelly had prepared, and it's really very comprehensive. I don't think I'll go through the bill a great deal. I just want to say that, you know, I have spent 20 years of my 30-year career teaching in alternative schools, and my experience is that these are good laboratories in many ways for understanding how kids learn. And I am very interested in this initiative in finding a way that our state government can say, you know, we're very strongly supportive of this kind of schooling and understanding how students learn. One of my mentors, Don Grimes, who founded the Mankato Wilson School in the 1960s, said we don't need just one kind of school. We need lots of different schools because there are lots of different learners. We need them not so they will compete with each other, but so that those different learners can find the right school for them. I think that's really an important thing to think about. I also remember that Chair Mariani asked Representative Benson, you know, why do we need this? And I think that one of the reasons we need this commission that will serve in many ways to foster and help these schools, but also to say to the state of Minnesota, this is an important venture that we're heading into. I remember several years ago, I served as president of the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, and we recognized in forming, as teachers forming that conference, that organization, how much we benefited from the exchange of information and the support to each other. But we were missing something else, and that was that kind of recognition from a state commission that could say to the state that these are important endeavors. So I think that's a reason that we really need this. I have with me a couple of testifiers, John Schroeder and Morgan Brown. Morgan is from the department, and they'll say a few words, and then we'll take any questions that you may have. I also have, because you have some idea of how we envision this commission working, a note from Audrey Suter, who is chair of the State of Minnesota Commission, and I'd like to just sort of pass those around to you so you can get a chance to look that over while you're listening to the other testifiers.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Trader from Education Evolving, and had Kurt Johnson been in town today, he would have been in this spot. As you recall, he was with you on Tuesday with Representative Benson's bill. And I wanted to point out that this is really one of three bills that all come under the general heading of New Schools Minnesota that Education Evolving is working with a number of legislators, departments, and education groups on in this session, all intended to raise the visibility and level of support in the state for innovation in education and for the creation of new schools. And you talked on Tuesday about Representative Benson's bill helping to create new schools in the district sector. That would be on a level playing field with the charter sector. And there are so many choices now available outside of the district sector that it's very important to have that same opportunity made available for districts, and that's what Representative Benson's bill would do. There was another bill that was heard on Wednesday in Representative Bradley's committee dealing with rural communities and the stresses that they're under and trying to come up with some mechanisms for helping them cope with a combination of declining enrollment and pressures for different kinds of choices in rural areas as well, and giving districts an opportunity to get ahead of that game and provide those options themselves. This is an attempt to pull all of this together at the state level and provide a new non-governmental or quasi-governmental focal point for leadership on new school creation and innovation in K-12 education. It's been very carefully constructed, so it's not going to cost the state a lot of money to do this. It's also not going to relieve the Department of Education of any of its existing responsibilities, rather providing support to the commissioner, really, in providing leadership in this area of innovation and new school creation, so that the recommendations for several programs, grant programs, and the new charter sponsor accountability program that you also dealt with earlier in the charter school bill goes through this entity, but ultimately the recommendations that really belong in government are left to the commissioner. So the recommendations would come from this group, but the actual decisions would be meeting with the commissioner. Representative Bly mentioned the parallel here with Serve Minnesota, and he's served on that board and very familiar with it. Perhaps others of you have been involved in that as well. And that's an entity that was spun out of the State Department into a freestanding nonprofit. So there's a very similar sort of rationale here for getting those functions out of the State Department and into a freestanding nonprofit organization. We've been persuaded, as we've looked around the country and listened to people like Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School, that in order for innovation to take place, in order for new ideas to really have a chance to catch on, they need some space and some separation from the place that they actually are trying to change. And this is our version of that. In fact, Kurt Johnson, who was here again on Tuesday, co-authored a book recently with Clayton Christensen about translating his research on how change does or doesn't take place in the private sector in K-12 education. And the biggest thing is to get some space and some distance away so that you can think about what might be done differently and act accordingly. And I think that Assistant Commissioner here, who's going to speak in a minute, can speak from his couple of positions he's held about the challenges of being an innovator within both the state and federal departments of education. This is also linked to state government by appointment. The members are appointed by the governor and the House and the Senate, and the commissioner is the chair. So we've really made a great effort here to have continuity and connections with existing agencies, but still that little bit of space that the developers of innovative ideas really need. So I think with that, we'll see if there are any questions, but I want to leave some time also for Morgan Brown so that he can bring the department's perspective and his own, I think, which is unique here in terms of having worked on innovation from within agencies.
Mr. Brown, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Morgan Brown with the Department of Education. I'm here on behalf of the Governor and Commissioner Segrin to speak in support of this bill. And the developers of this legislation have met with both the Governor and Commissioner several times. And I think they really have some strong feelings about supporting the concept that's embodied in this legislation for a couple reasons. First, as Mr. Schrader mentioned, the groundbreaking research that particularly Clayton Christensen has done is pretty compelling about what we've seen in other sectors of society about how you go about encouraging, catalyzing successful innovation in those sectors, and that perhaps that could be replicated and done as well in the public education arena. That's not to say that the department doesn't believe that we're not doing innovative programs right now and that we can't do innovation within the department. It really speaks to the idea that when you do what Mr. Schrader talked about creating a space or an entity that has more flexibility, more nimbleness in exploring innovation, you're likely to get different kinds of innovations than you would within an agency. And just very briefly, Mr. Schrader alluded to this. Prior to this current position, I was director of the Office of School Choice and Innovation within the department, and then for about a year and a half I ran the Office of Innovation at the U.S. Department of Education. So I struggle with a lot of these issues about how do you promote innovation within a federal or a state agency. Secondly, the Governor and Commissioner really like the idea of setting up an entity that looks at new school creation and innovations related to new school creation across the public education arena. I think as we've had discussions on charter schools recently, there's been a lot of concern expressed about silos being created for charter schools versus district schools, and that this would be one way to break down those silos in terms of looking at some commonalities in new school creation and sharing of effective practices. And then third, just to make clear that the department doesn't view this legislation as in any way kind of pulling authority away from the commissioner. If anything, the language really appears to be talking about a collaborative relationship with the agency, and as Mr. Schrader mentioned, the commissioner would still retain all of the authority she has currently, but she would have the benefit of the recommendations and work that this new entity, New Schools Minnesota, would have done. We do have a couple of concerns I just want to note about some language that's currently in the bill, specifically regarding the federal charter school grant program. We've had great discussions with Representative Bly and the developers, and they've agreed to make some changes in the bill to address those concerns. I understand the amendments aren't ready to be offered today, but they will be when we go to K-12 finance, and Representative Bly will be offering there, so we appreciate the discussions with him. I'm happy to answer your questions. Thanks.
Questions from members. Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for any of the three of you who might choose to answer this, but how would this nonprofit entity be different from an organization such as the Center for School Change?
It's actually a very fine line that we're trying to draw here between having the distance and stage in which we believe innovation will be more likely to, from which we believe innovation will be more likely to emerge, and having this direct accountability relationship with state government. So the appointment of the members of the commission and the final approval on any governmental decisions around funding and approval of sponsors, that becomes the norm. The precedent here is, or the model is served Minnesota, that operates under an annual contract with the department. So that in a way it's sort of a delegation of authority through contract and an accountability then back to the department. And we really believe that it's important to have that in order to have the kind of credibility that this needs and deserves, as opposed to being a totally freestanding nonprofit organization, a think tank outside of state government.
Hello, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take a little different tactic. How would this organization relate to entities like the Center for School Change?
Well, that's one of its missions, actually, is to help support and encourage and expand support activities in their schools. And I hope that you have this so buff-colored, or however it's become now, little handout on this whole initiative, the whole New Schools Initiative. Is that that around in a bill?
In this format, remember?
Oh. It changed from buck to what, I guess. But on the second page is what I've called the Salzman honorary get as much information on one page as you possibly can, even if you have to use 2-point type handout. She's the author over in the Senate, and she wanted all this on one page. And so this is really an effort to show how New Schools Minnesota, which is in the fourth box down, fits, and also site-governed district schools is the new player in the middle, and then expanded non-governmental infrastructure for all new public schools, district and charter. And so part of the purpose of New Schools Minnesota, quite frankly, is to raise money and help expand from the private sector and help expand the infrastructure for new school creation, both in districts and through chartering. And Morgan Brown said about trying to break down some of these barriers and silos and get collaboration and replication back and forth and learning from these various kinds of public schools we have in Minnesota is one of our objectives, and having this not discriminate on the basis of the nature of the school organization, but focus instead on innovation and new schools, regardless of how those schools are created. So part of the goal is to strengthen this line across the bottom, which is expanded non-governmental infrastructure for all new public schools, and that would include organizations like the Separate School Change.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's quite interesting that this is modeled after Serve Minnesota, which both Representative Bly received appointments to be part of that committee as the ex officio members. So it brings me to the membership portion of your bill. In the Serve Minnesota model, we have one member from each the minority and the majority party within each body. And I'm wondering if you, the author, would be willing to talk about the structure of the government, of the membership of this regarding the legislature between now and the next committee to see if we could have more balance party-wise on that committee.
Of course. Senator Black.
Yes, I would be willing to talk to you.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just remind you, we just passed through this committee and approved some significant new legislation on charter schools. How does the language in your bill mesh with that new legislation?
Well, I don't think that this necessarily is in conflict with that at all, in a sense it may be somewhat supportive to looking at or understanding or promoting or even having good conversation about the charter schools, but it really isn't aimed at governing charter schools in that way. It really is trying to bring together the people who are talking about innovation in education. I might say, you know, the fact that a school is a charter school doesn't mean it's an innovative school. It could be a very traditional school, not that that's good or bad or wrong or right. But what we're interested in is trying to promote conversation about innovation and attract some funding and support for that. And as to Representative Viner's question about how is it different or how does it relate to others, I really believe that having, in a sense, the state sanction of this kind of endeavor effort is very important, and that the state recognize that it's, that by establishing a commission, we're saying, yes, this is an endeavor that we want to pursue. You know, just as Representative Benson's bill raised the stature of teachers and said, you know, we're going to trust teachers to move forward and create the kinds of schools and innovation that we want. What we're saying, we're saying that a little bit further and saying, you know, we want to see this innovation come forward, and we're going to create a commission that will support that.
Chairman, if I could just one very specific response to the question. Bill and language, and it was written in anticipation of inclusion, as it is in the charter school bill, a new process for approving sponsors. And so that's one very specific area where this is in alignment, that the applications for sponsors would come through New Schools Minnesota, and then the recommendations made to the commissioner for approval or not. And we think that's an important function, and one that would be a new activity in state government, but it was written in anticipation of that also passing.
Mr. Brown, further comment?
Mr. Chairman, just to add to what Mr. Schrader said, the one other way of Representative Deskey may overlap with the department's originally proposed charter school legislation. You may remember that we had proposed reestablishing the Charter School Advisory Council, and the committee decided that they did not want that included in the bill. But in some ways, New Schools Minnesota really could absorb those responsibilities of being an advisory group to the commissioner on charter schools. It's just that now they wouldn't be looking just at charter schools, but at new schools and school innovation across the board.
Representative Barnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to monopolize the discussion, but I'll just give you a little background here. I'm very interested in innovation in schools. I've been very active in it most of my life as a parent and as a board member, but I have a great deal of concern about the public aspect of public schools, and creating this non-governmental entity raises some concerns for me. It's much along the lines of the discussions around the legislature and in the public these days about the relationship between citizen-appointed bodies and legislators as elected officials and what our role is as a voice for the public. And I have concern about the downside of separating this kind of entity from governmental structure, because clearly we have given sanction to charter schools in a variety of ways, and I do understand the need for the research base and that in connection to innovation, but I'm a little uncomfortable with this non-governmental entity aspect. So just to lay that out there, that's my concern. I don't know if you can allay it or not.
Well, I think that I understand your concern, and I don't mean to discount it at all. It is important. But I think also, if we're going, in my own experience, having worked in public schools, in public alternative schools, without, for lack of a better phrase, a countervailing force that encourages this kind of innovation or supports that innovation, these kind of innovative programs are easily co-opted by the change of an administrator. I benefited in my own school for about 15 years by my superintendent, Charlie Kite, who understood our program and wanted us to be able to be creative and innovative and have the kind of school that would serve the students we were serving. And so he understood that in many ways to leave us alone to make sure we were doing our jobs and educating the students, but to create the kind of environment that would really serve those critical students. So, and I would say that that program lost all of its innovation with a three-minute conversation with a different administrator.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think we need some time to sort out all of the entities that have been proposed during this legislative session. Everything from a new state board of education, which we haven't had before. We have three or four other, the P16, where the legislature would be involved. Plus we've got three or four other kinds of innovative research bodies that have been proposed. And they all have a particular piece of this governance, and it seems to me this just adds another piece to that, and I have real concerns about the role of this. Is it necessary? Seems to me we just did the charter school law and revamped that, and it looked like it had some new pieces for oversight, and I have real concerns about what this would do and its role and responsibilities.
I'm going to take a stab.
Representative Black.
Thank you, Chair. I think that my sense of this is that it has the potential of bringing a lot of those together determining or having a way to talk about all of those little bits and pieces, having a more centralized view of what innovation could go forward and what providing some guidance and another filter for some of those things to help the legislature make decisions about what to endorse and what not to. Maybe John or Morgan has some other ideas about that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Peterson, that's true. Then that's really one of the identified missions or activities of the organization is to be always alert to public policy opportunities or changes that need to be made in order to help or remove barriers to innovation and creation of new schools, new public schools in Minnesota. We realize this too, that there are a number of proposals for a variety of pieces of infrastructure. And ultimately, when asked that question of how much of this need, how much of this we need, and particularly how is it all financed, and that's why we wanted to tie this. This is a very delicate sort of balance between being a non-governmental entity and having the space and the distance from government to be able to be more objective and produce more innovative ideas, but still be accountable to and supportive of state government in its role in setting policy, in this case, or carrying out policy in other areas. So we think it's a pretty unique role, and I guess for those of you that have experience with serve Minnesota, I think trying to think about that experience and the amount of money that they've been able to raise and add to voluntary community service programs in Minnesota as a result out of the private sector has been very significant, and having the credibility of being attached to state government is important to that, and also just the way they've been able to perform their responsibilities in that environment. So we think unique. We don't think this is duplication. We think it's as much supportive of state policymakers as it is innovation in the system of schools.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to speak in favor of the bill. This is a complementary bill with the one that the committee so graciously passed a few days ago. I do know that the session is moving along, and whether or not this bill will be heard in K-12 finance, I'm not sure. It may not, from what I hear. But I would like to get the support or ask my fellow members to support this bill so that the dialogue can continue. I'm very grateful for the strong support from the Department of Education and the governor in this, and it's a wonderful example of bipartisanship to try to move the process of education reform forward, and I think it would be unhelpful if the committee at this point rejected it. At least it shows support for the policy, if not the implementation at this point. And that would also give us time to continue the dialogue. So I urge the committee members to support this bill.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share some of the concerns of Representative Peterson. We have so many different organizations and new alignments proposed here, but I'm really conceptually extremely supportive of this. And one thing that jumps out at me is, I guess it's Subdivision 3, Section 2, line 2.12, where you specifically reference assisting districts in severe fiscal distress, perhaps kind of developing models that would allow those districts to continue serving those schools. I mean, we hear almost every day in various committees about the pain being felt by districts that are having to consolidate or close down. Can you provide some examples of the kinds of things that you're thinking about there, and whether that would, if this commission were launched, actually produce some immediate short-term benefits for some of these districts really in that tough situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, directly to the top of this page, first page of this handout, which calls this, and you can take it or leave it as a bold initiative, but The intent here is to do two things, improve student learning and address the fiscal sustainability of public education in Minnesota by creating new and fundamentally different public schools. And we believe that this is now on a two-pronged, two-part objective here that we have to be using innovation for, both for improving student achievement and continuing the fiscal feasibility of public education throughout Minnesota and for the wide variety of students and the different kinds of learning needs that we have. And so part of the role here might very well be replication in districts. Here's just one example. Replication in districts of some of the experience that we've gained in the teacher professional practice schools that are largely chartered schools here in Minnesota, but there are some district versions of these in other states. And in Wisconsin, they have, their charter schools are very much like the kinds of schools that would be authorized by Representative Benson's bill. So there's an example of being able to take a methodology, a way of organizing the functions in a school, the personnel in a school, and translate it into a smaller district school. That's just one example. There are lots of uses of technology also that have potential for cost savings that are being used here and there in district schools and in chartered schools. And we believe that there are a number of different ways in which public education needs to be made more cost effective, maintaining the goal of improving student achievement. And this would be a very important catalyst for sharing of those methods and ideas across different kinds of public schools in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. Representative Lynn.
I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank Representative Bly and the others for your testimony. I apologize for missing your earlier comments. So if I ask anything that's repetitive, I do apologize. Two questions. One, first, are you envisioning incorporating any of the activities or ideas emerging from some organizations like Teach for America or things happening across our country as part of this initiative? And secondly, with regards to the sheet on your proposal, you're presuming, quote, a significant commitment of public and private fiscal and organizational support from various entities. Could you give us, and that's probably more of a finance question, but just kind of what you envision from a blue sky perspective right now of what kind of balance you're envisioning at the beginning and maybe where you would be going as this organization would mature.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. I'd ask that we try to keep our comments as limited as possible.
I think perhaps the best example might be the handout that you got from sort of Minnesota, and you can see a breakdown of private, federal, and state. And as that organization has matured, it has been able to attract more private dollars. But a lot of it is, you know, the federal money, and there is some state money. But it's really a way of beginning that process where you have to start with some seed money, perhaps from somewhere, and then you attract the private investment as you are doing things. As to, you know, your question about would we be looking at other models or other things that are out there, certainly I think wherever there's innovative ideas, whether it's from somewhere else in the country or from some other country or within Minnesota, we're interested in promoting those ideas. In my experience, which is why I'm so excited about Representative Benson's bill, is that the best innovation comes from a mix of the teachers, parents, and students, and communities that these schools emerge in, rather than having some idea that you pluck from somewhere else and bring in. And that's one of the things that excited me about being president of this Minnesota Alternative School Association, was learning about these different kinds of schools that were emerging all across the state and were really based, the best ones were based on that kind of cooperation. And because they were very receptive and mutable, in a sense, by the needs of the students and responsive to parents' wishes and desires, and relied on the resources and passion of the teachers as well as the resources of the community.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Please come forward, state your name for the record.
My name is
Keith. For the record, and welcome.
Thank you. My name is Keith Lester. I'm superintendent of Brooklyn Center Schools, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me a chance to speak on this. I don't know a lot about this. I didn't come here to talk about this, so if I ramble a little bit, I'll try to speak quickly because I know you have other business. Many of you, some of you at least, know that I've been talking about with Brooklyn Center, the innovating using the full service community schools model that is in place in public schools all over the country. I think, and listening to what you've had to say, that there's a place for a connection there, and there's no question. My concern is similar to what others have said, how many different silo bills might there end up being. Not that I think my bill or our bill or whatever it is would get through, but I'm saying that that's a proven track record, and there are public schools that have been entrepreneurs. We survive by innovation. We have collaborations with multiple organizations, and I have commitments from a number more that are ready to join us. Imagine if we took their vision, combined it with public school entrepreneurs, if you will, and put all of those pieces together and built something, rather than you try this, because we're already doing it, and we're, as I'm going to talk about, I hope, in integration, the kids are in school today, and we can't wait for somebody else to create something else. We have to rebuild from within what we're doing, and I think that the community schools model is a good one. I'm sure I know there are other ones. I'm betting there's research that says that innovating from within can also be successful if you have an organization that's capable and willing to do that. And so I would welcome the opportunity to have discussion with your group and Representative Benson, the people that are supporting that with you, and say, if we're going to do this, let's do it right, and let's put all of our pieces together. I was listening to what you said. You know, my pitch, if you will, has been it'll reform education, community schools, and it will provide opportunities for shared services, efficiency, reduce redundancy, save money. That's exactly what you're hearing here, and the research is out there on community schools, too, and that's what that's saying. So I would encourage you, as you look at these, to look and say, let's look at the whole picture then and see what we can do to support it. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Newton renews his motion that House File 981 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to the K-12 Education Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1240, and that is with Representative Eakin. He's here. The chair moves that House File 1240 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that it be referred to the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division. Representative Eakin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have an amendment as well that I would like to have moved. I could have that done.
Yes. I hope everybody has that in their packet. So it's the A1 amendment. The chair moves the adoption of the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author intends. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1240 deals with the Dakota and Ojibwe language revitalization. The goal of the bill is to create a working group, and it would consist of representatives from the 11 federally recognized tribes here in Minnesota. It would also include members of the urban Indian communities of the Twin Cities and Beirut, also the Commission of Education, the Board of Teaching, members of the legislature, all coming together to develop a strategy for the tribes and the state to work together toward the goal of revitalizing Dakota and Ojibwe languages. And it is an honor for me to be carrying this bill today. For too long, we have seen great damage done to the culture of the Native American people. I think this bill goes a long ways towards helping to revitalize that culture and the identity of many young Indian people, in particular with the Native American culture. I do have with me today at least two individuals who would like to speak, and maybe a third as well, so three individuals who would like to speak today. First of all, we have Ms. Marissa Carr and Ms. Lillian Rice, and your name again is Marissa Carr. Okay, thank you. So if I could have them speak, that would be great.
Great, just please state your name for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
My name is Marissa Carr. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm in many Dokra and Vision Cars, Mr. Malpit Mooney, Benjamin Mooney, Donna, Owen, the Commodore, and I'll give you your own line. Hello, my name is Marissa Carr, and I would like to talk a little bit about what's going on with our languages. Particularly, I would like to talk about some of the challenges involved in trying to save our indigenous languages here in the state of Minnesota. I currently work as an Ojibwe language and raising preschool teacher for the HOA member of the Kendon Early Child Fundraising Program in South Minneapolis. And I've been involved in other languages, all those recent efforts for my language, which is Ojibwe, for several years. I know that you guys have a lot to get through, so I try to keep my comments very brief. One of the main challenges that we have in revitalizing our languages in the state of Minnesota is that we're trying to do immersion programs. Immersion has been proven through the experience of other indigenous groups like the Hawaiians and the Maoris and also the Blackfeet in Montana and even Ojibwe with immersion programs in Wisconsin just to try to build it to be a very effective way, if done properly, of creating fluent speakers of a language. And there are a lot of people trying to work in immersion programs, or start immersion programs in Minnesota, including the one I work for. But the problem is we have very few, if any, certified teachers to work in our immersion programs. We have very few people who are fluent enough in the language to be able to function in an immersion setting, which means speaking only the Dakota or Ojibwe all day and doing everything in that language. We also have teacher licensure, so that's a really big challenge. Another one of our challenges is that we have to create all the own curriculum and materials, which in Dakota and Dakota are not traditionally written languages. So unlike other classrooms, we need to go to the library and find a book to use or, print out on a curriculum plan. Anything that we use, we have to either create from scratch or translate into our language. And I brought for you guys some examples of some of the books that we've made in our language for our program. This is a traditional Anishinaabe program that we made a book into to use for our classroom. So I think that's what I am if you guys would like to look at that.
Thank you.
I also have some handouts about the Dakota and Ojibwe languages. There are some books in both Ojibwe and Dakota that we've made and translated for our classroom. Another really big challenge that we face is that there is very little coordination of efforts to revitalize our languages in the state of Minnesota, which means that when we're not working together, we all keep on kind of reinventing the wheel and accomplishing the same thing separately instead of building on each other's work and being able to move forward. And I think that the ability to coordinate our efforts and move forward is one of the big things that would be accomplished by this bill. On the handout that I'm passing around, it says that there are 26 speakers in the Dakota language. That handout was made in 2004. Today there are, I believe, 6 speakers in the Dakota language. But that's how quickly the language can go. And for my language, in Snowdonian, right now we have, it's amazing, maybe 100 speakers, but in 10 years we'll be in the same situation as the Dakota language. I've been to a lot of funerals before already for elders who are fluent speakers in our language who have passed away. the youngest speaker that I was, but I can think of is 61 years old, and most much older than he is. So it's very important that we have the opportunity to do this well able to, and I think that's all I have to say. Thank you so much for me.
Thank you very much. Our next testifier, please state your name and please proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Lillian Stan. I am an Ojibwe, raised in Red Lake, born in White Earth. My mother married into the Red Lake tribe. And from the way I've been raised, my folks were punished for speaking their language when they were young. They didn't teach me. I therefore didn't teach my children. And I regret that very much. We don't have that many elders left to teach us the language the way it's supposed to be spoken. And one of the urban immersion program that Margaret Boyer is from and Lillian Reich is from have taught my great-grandchildren to speak Ojibwe, and they go to the schools. The schools they're at, they speak the language. One of my great-grandchildren speaks it over the intercom three times a week in Ojibwe. That's how much she's picked up in 2 years that she's been become acquainted with the language. But the real issue is that our elders are not here, are getting beyond their years. They're not going to be here that much longer, and I believe it's an urgency that we need to keep our culture going and for our children to be more comfortable with who they are.
Thank you.
My name is Lillian Rice. We're supposed to be duplicates, I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I greet you this morning. I was asked to come here and do a presentation. I'm trilingual. I speak Potawatomi. It's my first language. Second language is Ojibwe and then English. So if I kind of break it up a little bit, you know, you'll understand where I'm coming from. And it seems like all my life I have been translating. When I was a little girl growing up, I learned to speak English. And in speaking English, I had to learn how to translate what my mother wanted to say or what my father was saying to English-speaking people. And it's like I'm continuing that work today. I'm one of the support people that work at Ojibwe and Fakenda program, our immersion program. And I really feel myself that we don't have enough time with these little ones. But we are doing the best that we can and working as hard as we can to help them learn the language and watch them grow in their self-esteem as they become aware that, you know, that we do have a language, and if we work with them, we're also building the child from within. And the people are right, Lillian and Marissa, saying that we don't have much time. As of right now, as I speak, I've heard of a couple of funerals going on, elders passing on. And I've often heard the word that when an elder passes away, it's like it's a whole dictionary that's gone. And right now I'm probably working with three or four other people in helping with the language, plus working with the little ones in the school system. I guess there isn't too much more that I can add to what I'm saying right now. Is that we don't have that kind of time. We really need to get together with these elders and really need to work with them in helping bring us back. Because the language, our language, it's a very sense of who we are. In our ceremonies, our values, our way of life, without that, we're lost. So with that, I'll quit.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of questions for members. Representative Jepke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony this morning. One of the things that I wanted to ask, and I'm not sure that Representative Aiken is involved in it, and maybe you aren't. We do have a partially governmental sponsored commission in the state of Minnesota. It's called the Minnesota Humanities Center. And one of their missions is to do exactly what you're talking about. They currently publish books, and they go throughout the state working with different language barriers. They publish books that actually are sent all over the world, and they're one of the few centers in the United States that does that, and they're located here in St. Paul, but they work throughout the state. Have you had any contact with the Minnesota Humanities Center? Because I know that they do presentations on the Ojibwe Nation, and I do believe they have published one book, but if you are... That would certainly be a place that you could partner on this.
Ms. Carr? Thank you, Mr. Members of the committee. Our program has had a little bit of contact with the Minnesota Humanities Center, but when it comes to issues of curriculum, the problem is not so much having the books published because, you know, I mean, that's another step, but what really is time-consuming and difficult is translating the materials. And that takes a lot of time. And then there are a lot of different dialects of the Ojibwe language. And in the state of Minnesota, it varies from reservation to reservation, but even from community to community within the reservations. And because of that, if we were to have one set published format of a book, it might be useful for the purposes of our program, but it might be difficult for somebody in Leech Lake or Malak or Redwood to use. So because of that, sometimes it's easier for us not to have kind of a bound published copy of the book, because if we share, you know, the computer file, then they can make the necessary adjustments to make it appropriate to their own dialect. So we have had a little bit of contact with them, but the actual publishing is not so much where we run into difficulty so much as the time it takes to translate all of our curriculum.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Anne Marie Hill, Indian Affairs Executive Director. Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee, one of the things that we will be doing in this overall effort is looking for a unified strategy. So a suggestion like yours, we'll be seeking out these people or these groups to come together and work with us throughout this two-year process, because that is the purpose of what we're doing. So we will just be looking for everybody possible who can put together a unified strategy.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I'm not sure who the question would be directed at or to, but first of all, the handouts at first glance looks like it's a pretty complicated or difficult language. It looks very difficult. But anyway, my question is, Concordia College has a number of language camps. Do you know if there's any Native American languages included in their curriculum at all?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, members of the committee, I believe that there are not any Native languages in the Concordia language camps, and I know that one of the things that various groups throughout the state of Minnesota have been working on has been to create language immersion camps for Ojibwe and Dakota, but As far as I know, Concordia doesn't have any language villages for the Ojibwe or Dakota languages at this time anyway.
Well, thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? If not, the chair renews his motion that House File 1240 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that be re-referred to the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Eakin, and your testifiers. The next bill on our agenda is House File 898. Representative Hornstein. The chair moves that House File 898 be recommended to pass and referred to the Transportation and Transit Oversight Policy Division. Representative Hornstein, I believe that you have an author's amendment to your bill.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Labeled the A3.
Yes, and then I have a oral amendment to the A3 amendment, so I don't know if you want to take those separately or...
Why don't we just incorporate that into the A3, if you would, members, if you'd take out the A3 amendment for House File 898, and Representative Hornstein, where would that amendment be?
On line 1.17, between the words upon and renovation, insert the ratio of... And then on lines 17 and 18, 1.17 and 1.18, delete approaching 60% of the replacement cost. And insert after cost to the cost of replacement.
All right, members, line 1.17 then would read, and Representative Hornstein, please correct me if I am wrong. Replace a facility must not be solely based upon the ratio of renovation costs to the cost of replacement.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, so that is the A3 amendment then with an incorporated amendment within. Members, any questions on the A3 amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hornstein, to your bill.
Thank you very much. And let me just clarify for the committee why we did this amendment and the oral amendment. We wanted to make sure that some of the concerns of the School Boards Association were met, and I believe that this amendment does that. With the oral amendment, we made it a little less specific and prescriptive, so that also helped in our efforts to collaborate. So, members, this is a broader bill concerning land use issues, energy, transportation, and the purview of this committee is sections 5 and 6, and I know that the chair really wanted us to stick to that, and it's our intention just to really have our testimony very, very narrowly focused on the parts of the bill that relate to schools and education. And Mr. Chair and members, this is, a broader bill related to land use planning and transportation with really a goal to reduce our dependence on oil and with its adjacent environmental and national security benefits of doing such. The corollary here and what this section of the bill addresses is how we plan and site new schools. And so in addition to some of the energy conservation benefits to this policy, we also have health benefits for children and the need to be walking and getting out rather than dependence on our ever more expensive school district provided transportation. So there's a lot of benefit to the schools and kids from this kind of approach to school siting. I have two experts that will testify to this section of the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to introduce them now, if that's okay.
Yes, Representative Hornstein, have them fit it into the record, and we look forward to their testimony.
Okay. Our first testifier is Dr. Tony Filipovich from Minnesota. Oh, I'm sorry, John Bailey from Thousand Friends of Minnesota.
Mr. Bailey.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good morning, committee. I appreciate your time. I'll keep my my comments very brief. My name is John Bailey. I'm with Thousand Friends of Minnesota. We're a statewide membership organization addressing important connections between our development patterns and health of our communities and the environment. I'm going to add a little bit more into what Representative Hornstein said, a little bit more detail on what this bill actually does. I think Dr. Filipovich will hear it after me. We'll give some really good local examples. I think we'll bring this story home. First of all, this here in my hand, this is a guidebook that the Department of Education puts out if you want to build a new school. It's the guidebook for planning school construction projects in Minnesota. And this is what the commissioner reviews when she has new proposals for new school construction. And this is what, and then this guidebook deals with all sorts of things, from the size of a gymnasium to how many tables in a cafeteria, etc. What our bill only addresses are two parts of the recommendations, two of the recommendations in this guidebook. One are what I call these minimum acreage requirements. And what these are is that if you want to build a new school, you have to build so many acres for an elementary school, so many acres for a high school, so many acres acres for middle school. The second recommendation are what I call these so-called 60% rule of replacement. And what this means is that if you choose to build a new school and the replacement cost or the renovation cost become 60% of what the replacement cost would be, the recommendation is just go ahead and build a new school and don't rehab. And what we saw, what these two recommendations do is they really limit local control and local creativity when oftentimes local communities, school boards, city councils, organizations and local towns want to sometimes reuse an existing school, build a school on a smaller footprint. Oftentimes these footprints and requirements for, say, high schools can be 40, 50 acres sometimes. You can still get, for a much more affordable price and really serve the community better, a school on a smaller footprint, and sometimes use existing buildings as well. So the challenge we have is limits local control, limits local creativity, also tends to often kind of push schools and development further out on the edge, again, kind of adding to local fiscal costs and local transportation costs as well. What, you know, I did mention this guidebook, and what this guidebook is, and the challenge we have is that this guidebook isn't in law. These are really just recommendations. But what has happened over the last 30, 40 years in using this guidebook is they've become de facto requirements. In school boards all around the country and in communities, especially in smaller towns in Minnesota, this is where this has been a real challenge, have really interpreted these recommendations as being a law. And that's why what we're doing in our amendment and in our bill is to really make sure there's more local control. The commissioner doesn't need to look at these kind of arbitrary acreage requirements and arbitrary 60% rules about replacement. One other thing I want to make clear on, though, we really wrote this in a specific way to not limit the ability of school boards and communities to build larger schools as well. Because there's certainly a reason to do that and a need to do that, and we're really trying to get out of the game of a kind of a cookie-cutter approach to how we build schools and build infrastructure. So if you need to build a larger school, that's fine. There's reason to do it. But importantly, if you want to really reuse that existing and historic school or build a school on a smaller footprint, you have the freedom to do that. And I'd end this by saying this is in line with national trends. The Council of Educational Facility Planners, this is CEFP, and this is a national organization comprised of architects, developers, and builders, the people that build all the schools, in their guidebook that they released in 2004, they eliminated minimum acreage requirements. You know, this is the closest we have to a national certifying organization of people that build schools, and they said, you know what, you don't need them. And so I think that Minnesota should follow what other states have done since CEFP did that. States as diverse as Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Rhode Island, South Carolina, and kind of get rid of those minimum acreage requirements as well. And the reason states have done this are for a few reasons, and why we think Minnesota should as well. One is for health. Generally speaking, older schools in smaller footprints, tend to have higher rates of walking and biking, improving student health. Preservation as well. You know, in many states, the reason has been, and especially again in smaller towns, what this can lead to is often the abandonment of historic schools. This is why we're really gratified to have the support of the Preservation Alliance in Minnesota that supports this concept in other states. So they've been, preservation organizations have been very supportive as well. And it ends just by the fiscal cost. You know, when larger schools are built further outside of town, there are often higher public costs that are hidden. Costs for roads and sewers and utilities. These costs, of course, are borne by state transportation departments and local governments when the larger school is finally built, but they're never included in the price of the new school. And this is where that 60% rehabilitation rule becomes quite pernicious, because the argument is that, well, the land is, quote, cheaper further out on the edge, and while the land might be cheaper, that so rarely ever includes the full cost of roads, sewers, utilities, sidewalks, etc. So we urge support of this bill, and with that, I'll go to Dr. Flipovich.
So, Mr. Chair, members, this is my privilege to introduce Dr. Tony Flipovich from Minnesota State Mankato, Department of Urban and Regional Studies, and in the interest of full disclosure, he is the husband of Representative Miner.
We will allow her to ask some difficult questions, though, if she so chooses. And others, and others.
We've never stopped doing the best.
Okay, guys.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm here to speak to HF 898, specifically Sections 5 and 6, as they relate to the minimum acreage requirement for Case 12 school siting. I speak from several capacities. I am professor and chair of the Urban and Regional Studies Institute at MSU Mankato. I am a member and past chair of the Mankato Planning Commission. I've served on a number of demographic and site evaluation committees for ISB 77 in Mankato, and one of my areas of academic specialization is the effect of urban living on the quality of life for children. I support the language in Section 5 of the bill that removes the minimum site requirements for a favorable finding by the Department of Education under the Guide for Planning School Construction in Minnesota. I support the language in Section 6 that addresses the pedestrian and bicycle connectivity of school sites and takes into consideration the cooperative use of existing public facilities. This language is in keeping with national trends to reconsider minimum site requirements. Research has demonstrated potential gains in health, savings, and innovative collaboration between schools and the community. It is also in keeping with trends in city planning, which are emphasizing higher densities, mixture of uses, and greater use of transit, pedestrian, and bicycle modes of transportation. I've provided in the handout in your packets further information about the impact of minimum acreage school site requirements. You have an example of this not 1 mile from this building in the Wellstone School on Kellogg Avenue. In my own community of Mankato, we have a policy of neighborhood-based K-5 schools. One of these schools, Roosevelt, is in an existing neighborhood that was built out around World War II. It's a K-5 school for 360 students built on 3 acres in 1927. It was built in the center of the neighborhood. It's connected to the neighborhood by sidewalks and by a dedicated bike and walking trail. The neighborhood is strongly attached to the school, but the district cannot replace it on site. A new building would require a location on the periphery of the city, at least 1.5 miles from its present location, not connected at all into the pedestrian or the bicycle way system. A second example is Lincoln Community Center. It's a former 912 high school built in 1921. It's on 3 acres in the center of an even older neighborhood. It's on a landlocked site, and yet there is high density in the neighborhood. In both cases, the cost of replacements would be about the same as the cost of building new, but the replacement would preserve the historic facade. It would maintain neighborhood coherence and, by the way, community allegiance to the schools even after the children have graduated from those schools, and it would lessen greenhouse gas emissions by reinforcing denser city development and transportation choices other than the automobile. Our voters in Mankato recently approved a referendum that included 2 new school sites. While the cities are trying to encourage smart growth in new neighborhoods, the school district had to identify 20 to 30 acre sites. That's the equivalent of 10 city blocks for 2 K-5 schools. The only choices were on undeveloped land in, on the periphery of the built up areas in both cities. Sites such as these create growth poles on the edge of the city, which encourage sprawl and further encourages greenhouse gas production. I urge your approval of HF 898.
Questions from members? Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just had a question on the, and this is a money question, maybe it's not even appropriate, but how much authority do we have to spend money or tell Met Council to spend money? It looks like we're taking money out of the Liverpool Communities Fund. Do we have the authority to tell them that they must?
We are only looking at sections 5 and 6 for what our purview would be, but I don't know if Representative Hornstein, if you want to quickly just offer any insight.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norris. This Liverpool Communities program was created by the legislature, and I think within reason, and I think in certainly we have the authority to look at that program and through statute allocate monies. I think that the Met Council, in fact, is seeking our authority to do that, to shift some livable communities money for transit purposes during this session. So certainly within our jurisdiction to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein. This is actually my second opportunity to hear about this bill, but specifically with regard to the portion affecting schools. Could you talk to the committee a little bit about what authority is retained yet by the local school board and sort of making the determination on best where they feel they need to locate new facilities? School facilities or renovated school facilities, because I think the committee is going to be very concerned about understanding that this would retain local control and how this really just affects that process of determining where best to either renovate or relocate a new school.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hornstein and Mr. Bailey.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair and Representative Luna, I think it retains and even enhances local control, but I'll have Mr. Bailey talk to the specifics of that.
Mr. Bailey. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, this amendment was drafted specifically to address that concern, and that's why the School Board Association, I think, Ms. Kelleher is in the audience, but she's right there, was drafted to make that, and as you'll notice in paragraph B about the local school board retains the authority, and we say it again in paragraph C, we really wanted to bias very strong on making that clear, that school boards really would retain this authority, and the last thing we wanted to do was kind of have an additional mandate on school boards, but if it would be okay, I could ask.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if it would be permissible, I would like to hear from the School Boards Association on their position.
Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Representative Loon, my name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We have worked closely with Representative Hornstein on the school-specific language. We specifically like sections B and C because they do retain local control and make it clear that the school board can make the best decision for the students and the community. We were hampered by the management guidebook, and basically the department used it as a checklist. So in fact, we present our building plans to the department, and if we, went over that 60% mark, we were actually given our application back and said, well, we don't accept this. You go back and change it and bring us another proposal. So this makes it very clear that we can not only get around the acreage requirement, but also have the flexibility to look at renovation. Since these items have to go eventually, the board has to take them before the public for a vote, we really do want the best solution for our communities, and more than any other local government, school districts have to make sure they really feel the pulse of their community, and we welcome that. I want to draw you to number 16 there and make it very clear that that's using existing information about sewer, water, and roads. That's really outside the school district's jurisdiction, but it's something we can add to the application as it goes not only to the commissioner for review, but also when we take it to the public. And as a school board member, I helped build a building. I know it's items we looked at and considered. It's important to have water in your school building and sewer spot lines and electricity. So those are normally things we consider. And I really appreciate the hard work Representative Hornstein's done to make sure this works for us. Before that, the guide that was shown was sort of the ruling law for districts, and this makes it very clear that these are local decisions. And
I think the check and balance is the public also has to approve it's the right decision.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Representative Dabney.
Pat, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions were along the lines of Representative Lewin's. Representative Hornstein, I like the idea that we give school districts more control. I've always been a little bit puzzled by sending the plan up to St. Paul and having them send it back down and say, we don't know if this works. I'm thinking, well, you've got architects, you've got local planning people. You think they take into account what works. We have zoning and we have regulations regarding in architecture, how many parking spaces we need and all that kind of stuff. So I've always wondered about that. So I like that portion of the bill, and I don't know too much about the rest of it. I won't comment on that. But the question I do have relates to the 60% and maybe where that came from. And I don't know if anybody from the department is here to give us some perspective on it. In my way of thinking, common sense-wise, why do we have that arbitrary number in there? And I like the idea that we're dealing with this and basically giving local school districts and local communities the option of making their own choice and decision based on cost and benefit analysis and that sort of thing. So if we could get a little rationalization from the department as to why I may be wrong, if this is a good idea, what you're doing, Representative Hornstein, I'd appreciate that.
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, I'm Michelle Weber with the Department of Education, and luckily I have Dr. Melcher with me in the audience as well, so we were able to quickly consult on this. We are not aware of the history behind why it's there and do have the opinion that it is somewhat arbitrary. It's just something that we have enforced based on the current practice.
Well, good, Mr. Chair. I guess my impression is that this enhances the ability of local communities, local school boards to make decisions about their school districts and what they think is best, and quite frankly, relieves some burden from St. Paul and the department, and I like that in the absence of any reason that we shouldn't change it. Thank you for bringing this forward, and I support that part of your bill. Can't say anything about the rest of it, and I won't, but I do, and I'm not making a judgment. I'm just saying it's not our purview, but I like what you're doing here. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Downing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too support kind of in isolation the provisions around the schools. I'm curious whether or not the school districts looked at kind of the chain of potential consequences on some of the other provisions in the bill. It appears that there's going to be kind of necessity a tightening of land use and maybe restrictions in comp plans about where school sitings could be or where commercial or residential development could be in order to conform to the goals here. Do we possibly, as an unintended consequence, actually increase the cost of our schools or just by virtue of the comprehensive plans that local communities are forced to develop to meet the other constraints, put a set of handcuffs on schools or add a set of costs to schools that we haven't contemplated? Did we look at that and think through that?
Dr. Flipovich?
Chair, Representative Downey, in my opinion, it will be the opposite. It will take handcuffs off the school. Right now, the requirements for minimum space requirements, one example of an increased cost is it almost forces the districts to place new buildings on the edge of the city, which increases transportation costs. Transportation costs are not part of the school siting decision, so it entails a cost that isn't calculated in the building construction, the annual ongoing transportation cost. If the district were able to rehabilitate an existing site where the transportation system is already in place, there's higher densities, non-school bus transportation system is more in place, the need for school bus the annual school bus transportation costs could actually decline. Second, if the trade-off is between more open space, the cost of land, and the cost of rehabilitating an existing site, which is less space, and there frequently the experience is that the cost of renovation will be about the same as the cost of new construction, but there is no additional land cost. And so again, there are possibilities of savings which right now are being foregone, the way the guidelines are established.
if the school district were to find that the cost of rehabilitation would outstrip the cost of a new site, my assumption would be that the district and the voters would say, well, we go to the new site. But right now, there is only the new site option, practically, for most of these locations, for a number of the built-up locations. So what this is doing is creating more options rather than forcing a school district. It doesn't say a school district has to build on an existing site, but it's bringing in more of those other, it's allowing the school district to think of those cost considerations when it's making its calculations, which the current guideline does not permit.
Any other questions from members? I do have one comment. As I was talked to about this bill from a few others, taking a look that it is a grant program and creating an opportunity for local units of government to implement some goal setting here. I would say to take a look at, I understand a lot of it is about land use as well as about, you know, the kind of the greening of our environments and such. I would say to look at how we implement or use those buildings as well. I think a lot of school districts are reorganizing where they'll make one school just a sixth grade school. And what that does is it takes away the neighborhood school concept for those sixth graders that are currently going to another building. And so as reorganization becomes a part of this too, it takes away that opportunity to walk or to ride your bike to school. And it also increases transportation costs because those students now are being bused to a school or a building that is now just for sixth grade. So I'd say take a look at that as part of your process about how it is that school districts can look at. It's not just about building a new school, but when you reorganize your schools and how they're going to offer programs, this might have an impact too.
Right. And Chair Jeff, set up my only audio-visual very nicely. I was given this, I didn't make copies in the interest of energy conservation, but I'll just read it. This says, Preservation Reusing America's Energy. Preservation Week, May 11th to 17th, 1980, has a picture of a school with in the top is an oil canister. It takes energy to construct a new building. It saves energy to preserve an old one. So, you know, this is really from 1980. There was a lot of consciousness about the need to conserve energy and conserve oil after the oil embargo. And here we are now some 30 years later, and you know, we're revisiting the same issue. So let's take the opportunity now that we didn't take then to preserve and conserve and use our energy more efficiently.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to expand on what you were saying, Mr. Chair, I like the idea of being able to save the schools and to use them and to make them more efficient. I'm not sure in terms of transportation. We have opened up the system with everything from magnet schools to charter schools to desegregation. I'm not sure, that, at least in the metropolitan area, if we're going to be able to save on the transportation and have that concept of community schools as much as we would like to have, because we're transporting kids all over the metropolitan area. And so I think we might be past that point in time where we can do that. But maybe people will want to stay in their communities if we design these schools. I'm not sure.
Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? The chair renews his motion that House File 898 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to the Cultural and Outdoor Research... Oops, sorry. Transportation policy. Be referred then to transportation policy. With that, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and
Member. I just had to where was going wrong. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 1340 with Representative Mariani.
That's right. I was like, cultural, outdoor heritage.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. And what a pleasure it is to, after a long day yesterday, to be able to kind of sit back a little bit and have Representative Cass run this meeting. He's moving this along really well, so hopefully I'll continue.
We're back on time. I'll tell you that. That's positive.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1340 be recommended to pass and recommended to the forwarded to the Finance Committee with a further recommendation that it move on to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Representative Mariani moves that House File 1340 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a further recommendation that be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Division. I believe you have an author's amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. I would move the A2 amendment.
The Chair moves adoption of the A2 amendment to put the bill in the form the author intends. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mariani, for your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll make just brief comments and do some brief walking through the bill, and then I'll ask our testifiers to come forward. As you all know, this year we heard from at least two high-quality alternative teacher prep programs that have obtained waivers to place high-quality emerging teachers in Minnesota schools. House File 1340 is an attempt to modernize our ability to grant a two-year resident teacher license for candidates from alternatives to post-secondary teacher prep programs. Eligible candidates can arise from either post-secondary programs or from a nonprofit corporation that's in partnership with a college or university with an approved teacher prep program. And it's that partnership part that is part of the amendment we just adopted. The Board of Teaching must ensure that the program serves to eliminate academic achievement gaps. Candidates must have a BA with a 3.0 GPA, or the Board of Teaching can raise to a 2.75 GPA, or a 10-year relevant professional experience. Candidates must pass exams that show reading, writing, and math skills. Candidates must pass Board of Teaching approved content and pedagogy tests. The programs must include rigorous characteristics. We list them in the bill. I'll just highlight three: minimum of 2 hour instructional preparation, be focused on research-based, resource-oriented best teaching practices, and then have a high-quality classroom-embedded staff development opportunity delivered by a resident mentor or a mentorship team. Members, I think in your packets we distributed letters of support from Superintendent Chris Carson from the St. Paul Public Schools. You'll recall she was here also earlier during our session and spoke broadly about the importance of having high qualified teachers in our classrooms, particularly to address academic achievement gap issues in regards to certain categories of disparities among student groups. There's also a letter of support from Superintendent Bill Green from the Minneapolis Public School System, letter of support from the Mayor of St. Paul, Mayor Chris Coleman, and then there's a joint letter of support from several Latino and African American educational leaders who are involved in providing academic K-12 academic services to area young people. Members, with that, today is my brief day, so I'll just be brief and I'll ask my testifiers to come forward and share information.
Before we move on, there is one slight technical amendment that needs to be brought forth on the original bill to make the amendment work. And so if members could please take a look at line 1.15, we need to strike the word "with." And that will make the amendment that we just adopted manageable. Any discussion on the oral amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the oral amendment to strike the word "with" on line 1.15, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign.
Yeah.
Motion prevail. All right, please state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Stacey Smith with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And first off, I want to thank Representative Mariani for bringing this bill forward. It's been great to work with them. The Business Community Supports Initiative to change the education system to improve student academic performance. As I've relayed to you all before, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce really believes that having a good workforce will help lead to Minnesota's global economic competitiveness. One of our greatest challenges, as you all know and as we've discussed over the last 3 months, is this academic gap between our advantaged and disadvantaged students. This bill aims to help close that gap. We believe that poor performing students are going to catch up to their peers, that they will require more support and innovative ways of learning. One of the key factors to closing the gap is to focus on high quality teaching, make sure there's a high quality teacher in every classroom. Teachers play such an important role in the lives of children, often leaving impact that lasts a lifetime. And Minnesota needs to ensure that our best people are leading the classroom. The evidence that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has seen shows that the quality of Minnesota students will not exceed the quality of our teachers, and that according to a couple of studies, one, University of Tennessee shows, if you take two average eight-year-olds, and you give one a high-performing teacher and one a lower-performing teacher, that over 3 years, the performance of those students diverges by 50 percentile points. Similar studies in Dallas and Boston demonstrate the same thing, that if you take a high-performing teacher and low-performing teacher, that the students experience that the student with the higher-performing teacher progresses 3 times faster than that who has the lower-performing teacher, and the one with the lower-performing teacher even regresses. So we know it's key to have a quality teacher, and I think everyone in this room knows that. The key point here is that this will help to bring more high-quality teachers and candidates into our education system. I think as 40% of our teachers reach retirement age over the next 10 to 15 years, we need to welcome high-quality teacher training programs. And this bill would allow several of those programs to come to Minnesota, and I think we're going to talk about that today. It's been a pleasure to work with the Board of Teaching on this bill and multiple stakeholders in the room to make sure that we have the best language to meet everyone's needs. And I would urge the support of House File 1340.
Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Kramer, and I am the president of Teach for America. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1340, which would create an alternative teacher preparation program and a resident teacher license. The passage of this bill is very important to Teach for America's ability to operate in Minnesota. As you all know, our state has the second largest achievement gap in the nation. Though our average results rank among the highest in the country, the cause of our gap is not because our wealthiest communities are outliers at the top, but because children growing up in Minnesota's low-income communities are at a greater disadvantage than children growing up in almost any other state in the nation. The sad reality that the zip code of a child's birth plays such a central role in determining his or her life prospects is an affront to our ideals as Minnesotans and Americans, and this is the problem that Teach for America exists to solve. Teach for America is building the movement to eliminate educational inequity by enlisting our country's most promising future leaders in the effort. We recruit, select, train, and support a core of outstanding recent college graduates and professionals of all academic majors and career interests to commit to teach for 2 years or more in low-income public schools, and through their experiences become lifelong leaders in the effort to expand educational opportunity. This year, over 35,000 people applied to Teach for America, including 25% of the senior class at Spelman, 11% of all Ivy League seniors in the country, and large numbers of seniors from McAllister, Carleton, Gustavus, St. John, St. Olaf, and the University of Minnesota. From this group, we will select approximately 4,000, just over 10%, to teach in communities across the country using a rigorous selection model built on our nearly 2 decades of experience predicting who will succeed advancing children. Our 2008 core had an average GPA of 3.6, 95% held leadership positions on their college campuses, and our 2009 core is shaping up to be even stronger. Nearly one-third of all Teach for America participants are people of color. Once in the classroom, Teach for America core members go above and beyond traditional expectations to make life-changing academic gains with their students. Over the last 2 decades, we have dedicated substantial time, energy, and resources to strengthening our approach to teacher preparation, induction, and development in order to maximize our impact in the classroom. Our program is entirely focused on what we have learned it takes to help students in low-income communities succeed. We operate an intensive pre-service training program that includes student teaching and instruction by Teach for America faculty, work collaboratively with institutions of higher education, and provide ongoing support through our staff of nearly 200 full-time instructional coaches who visit classrooms, review student work, and help core members improve their practice. A growing body of high-quality research demonstrates that Teach for America teachers perform at least as well and often better than teachers prepared in other ways. For example, the Urban Institute recently found that the incremental impact of having a Teach for America teacher was 3 times greater than the incremental impact of having a veteran, traditionally prepared, in-field teacher. The experience of achieving significant academic gains in low-income classrooms is transformative for the core members. As Teach for America teachers discover through first-hand experience that it is possible to close the achievement gap, the kids growing up in poverty can achieve at the exact same levels as their more affluent peers when given the opportunity, their dedication to eliminating educational inequity becomes a lifelong commitment. Since Teach for America's founding in 1990, over 20,000 people have entered the program. While less than 10% of them would otherwise have chosen to become teachers, more than two-thirds of our alumni from the last few decades are continuing to work in education full-time today. Half are still teaching and approximately 400 are serving as principals. While Teach for America is not currently operating in Minnesota, we are seriously considering bringing our first group of core members to Twin Cities schools this coming fall, starting in Minneapolis, Brooklyn Center, and charter schools across the metropolitan area. This bill would be an important enabler of that effort. Because there is no resident teacher license in Minnesota, we would have to operate through Minnesota Board of Teaching annual waivers, and core members would have to teach on temporary limited licenses. Neither of these are sustainable approaches over the long term, and both will serve to dissuade prospective core members from choosing to teach in Minnesota, since they will have no assurances that the program would continue for their second year. Furthermore, because of the absence of a workable alternative preparation program, our teachers will be subject to a certification framework that is designed for traditional programs. Core members will need to retake coursework that they have already mastered, and the design of the program will not fully take advantage of the fact that they are already full-time classroom teachers. Again, both of these factors will dissuade the most talented prospective core members from choosing to teach in Minnesota. This bill creates a framework that can solve all of these problems and gives the Minnesota Board of Teaching the flexibility to approve high-quality programs that prepare non-traditional candidates in alternative ways. Minnesota has historically been a leader in education reform in many ways, and we have a long and proud tradition of educational excellence. With the emergence of the current achievement gap over the last 25 years, there's a significant blemish on that record. The success we see in classrooms and schools across the state and country shows us that this is indeed a solvable problem, and one that I believe Minnesotans have a growing role to solve. Passing HF 1340 is a critical step to allowing non-traditional candidates, such as those recruited and trained by Teach for America, to become part of this solution. Thank you, everyone, including Representative Mariani, for introducing this bill.
Ms. Ballmer.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Ballmer with the Minnesota Board of Teaching. I'm here this morning to also offer our support for this bill and, of course, stand for any questions that you may have. As you have heard, a compelling case for Teach for America, and we have similarly heard a case for the New Teacher Project, specifically the program established called the St. Paul Teaching Fellows. We at the Board of Teaching have heard those cases and have been very interested in supporting the work and launch of those programs here in Minnesota. And so we have been working with these organizations over the last many months to find a way that we might be able to support them and bring these organizations here to Minnesota. You've also heard from local school districts and charter schools who are interested in partnering with these folks. We, too, have heard from those folks, and that has been part of our impetus for moving forward with these initiatives. But you've also heard this morning that our route for bringing these folks here through our licensure process is a bit on the complicated side. We do have some mechanisms available, but what you have before you is a way to create a standardized and more straightforward route for these folks to gain licensure during the time that they are in their two-year preparation program and teaching at the same time. We believe that it is critically important for the language that was just amended in this morning, that there is a connection to a higher education partnership or a higher education institution. We strongly support that language and believe that that provides a level of credibility and a level of assurance that we need to feel strongly about this bill and this proposal, and to ensure that there will be quality programs approved to do this work for us. So with that, I will certainly be available for questions that you might have, but want to sincerely note that we are excited about this possibility and look forward to these partnerships in the future.
Ms. Gilbert.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. I just want to add that we do support this bill. We do have the new Teacher Fellow Program in St. Paul. Nora Barrett was already here and did a presentation on it for this committee, so I'm not going to repeat any of the information. We do focus on the licensed areas where we are having trouble. We have about 90 either variances, community experts, or limited licenses right now, and so we focus on math, science, special ed, and ELL. The bill would allow us to not have to go through the process of going to the board every year to trying to get the program annually approved, and that would be helpful because as we look for some candidates, they may be hesitant to apply if they know that the program might not be continued.
Mr. Grassfall.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Grassfall with Minneapolis Public Schools. There's a letter from my superintendent in your board packet. I just direct your attention to that. I don't think I can say it better. We strongly support the bill. This would allow us to have new partnerships. We believe teacher quality is key, the key lever. I think what you're seeing is two of your large urban districts innovating, trying to develop new partnerships to close achievement gaps, and we'd urge you to support the bill to allow us to move forward with that work. Thanks very much.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I won't say anything other than we also support this bill. And frankly, the letter you have from Dr. Green says it about as well as anyone. So I think this is a wonderful opportunity for the state to attract some quality teachers to our classroom. Thank you.
Representative Mariani, do you have any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, I'd also maybe appropriate this to ask other members of the public wish to comment.
Good. If there are other members of the public that would wish to testify for or against this bill, please come forward. Dr. Prenn.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Maureen Prenn, and I'm currently president of MACSE and a professor at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And I'm here today representing MACSE. Our main concern that MACSE has about the proposed legislation is that all programs be held to the same standards. Those are the standards of effective practice that the Board of Teaching has set for everyone in content knowledge as well as knowing how to work with children. We do really appreciate the amendment offered by the chair to have higher education as a partner. Currently, Hamlin University is serving as a partner for both the New Teacher Project with the St. Paul Fellows as well as Teach for America. And part of what they've done as a partner with those programs is to set a unique way of obtaining those standards of effective practice that contains both coursework as well as examining experience and prior knowledge of the candidate. So I want you to know that despite the rules that we work with that are set by the Board of Teaching, we are trying to be flexible in how we apply those rules when we look at these kinds of innovative programs. We recognize and applaud what Teach for America has done, especially with recruitment and screening of high-quality, bright, young, idealistic people and putting them into the classrooms. One issue I want to bring up is who is recommending the candidate finally for licensure. Right now, that role belongs to higher education. Under this bill, it's done by a mentorship team. And my concern about that is my experience with mentoring, and Mankato has an award-winning mentoring program. We purposely avoid having that mentor in the role of evaluator because then the mentorship relationship cannot really develop and the candidate can't get as much from that relationship if the candidate has to consistently worry about being open and being fully direct with that mentor. So I want to bring that up as a caution to the chair and members of the committee.
Ms. Altschlager.
I'm Mr. Simmons, the community and Altschlager Education Minnesota. And we understand the intent of Representative Mariani's work, and he's working to try to make sure that we address the issues of the achievement gap. I just, one of the things that we also need to keep in mind, number one, we want to do everything possible to close the achievement gap. But I also want you to remember that we are one of the highest achieving states, and that makes our achievement gap look worse. Now, that just because we have high-achieving kids doesn't mean that we shouldn't put every effort towards improving the achievement gap. So I just want to say that up front. What does this bill really do? This bill allows Teach for America candidates and those in the classrooms not to have to apply for a limited license every year. this program, as I just confirmed with the Board of Teaching, can go on right now. We have various licensing provisions. The limited license, and as I said, you have to apply every year. And then there is an intern license, where somebody who is not a licensed teacher can work under the supervision of a licensed teacher. So we would certainly like to talk with the author and others about other possibilities. There used to be a program called CUE, Collaborative Urban Educators. There used to be a program called Teachers of Color. These were great programs. There might be some of these programs still, some leftovers still out there. But it's because the funding, I think, dried up that these programs are out there. And those were aimed at trying to get people into the types of situations, the types of classrooms, the types of individuals into the very thing that we're doing right here. We believe, let me go through the bill. On line 1.19, we are not sure how the Board of Teaching would ensure that the program serves to enhance. I just asked that question. How does the Board of Teaching ensure? You go to lines 2.9 in that area. There's a minimum of 200 hours, and we would ask, do we really think that if a individual has a minimum of 200 hours and they've passed a test, that they're really ready to go into a classroom to teach kids? When we have 30 kids in a classroom, are they qualified to do that? And what happens to the kids if it doesn't work out well? Again, as the previous testifier stated on lines 2.32, we have concerns about a mentor making a decision about whether or not that person is qualified to teach. Right now, the Board of Teaching holds everyone to the same standards, and we're giving that authority to a mentor. And we believe that the Board of Teaching should be the evaluator. And we are glad that they put in higher ed. A statement was made by the Chamber that several of these programs would come into Minnesota. It would be interesting for you to know how many licensed teachers are not teaching. We have had a tremendous number of layoffs over the last 5 years. So I'm talking about the economy right now, and I'm talking about jobs. And in a previous hearing, I believe Teach for America, and I stand to be corrected, said that they had a contract for 40 teaching positions, and I think it was within the Minneapolis-Brooklyn Center and Charter Group. So if we are not increasing funding for education, I'll just lay that scenario out there, and we're going to be cutting teachers, why are we starting a new nonprofit to create more teachers and to take possibly, you know, I'm not sure what would happen, 40 positions away from teachers who are in the schools? Like, I don't know how the arrangement has worked out. I know there's been discussions within the Minneapolis School District. But I really wonder if this is the time for it, especially when you have limited licenses, where the only obstacle that this bill is addressing is applying each year for that limited license. You can still have Teach for America exist under the current system. So we would ask that maybe you consider this at a later date and when the economy is stronger. Thank you.
I think we have a few questions from members. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for the author, and it might be a friendly amendment, and then I have one question. And I'm not sure, maybe I'd have to ask higher ed. In your amendment 1.3, it says an approved teacher program, and I'm wondering if you could be accredited. And can you respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, I don't really know the difference between that, but I would assume that the Board of Teaching is approving programs that are accredited. I believe that's correct.
Can somebody from the board?
Board of Teaching.
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson, we believe that approved teacher preparation program is the right language to use. That is our current structure where we approve programs on an individual basis. Each and every licensure program does go through an approval process. So that does align with our current infrastructure and language.
What would be the difference between approved and accredited?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson, accreditation would be along the lines of something like NCATE or something at the institutional level that would be national generally. When you're talking about teacher preparation programs, and my colleagues from higher ed might be able to speak better to that, but in the world of teacher preparation, accreditation generally has a national slant to it rather than a Minnesota specific. The Board of Teaching, nothing that we do currently would fall under the category or the language of accreditation. We would call it approval. And each institution is approved under a series of requirements that we have in rule, that they've got the infrastructure, the technology, the fiscal resources, the staffing. So there's an institutional approval, and then each and every licensure program has its own approval process. So we have not called it accreditation at the state level.
Dr. Price.
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, accreditation is, we have two organizations right now for teacher education, TEAC and NCATE, and it goes one level beyond what program approval or institutional approval is connected with the board, and it really is looking at more assessment data on how programs are performing. And so approval is the right way. We can operate in the state of Minnesota with just board approval. We can't operate with just accreditation.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. So I will withdraw that particular recommendation. And then I also wanted to ask the author why you went from the 3.0 to the 2.75. That was a little bit of a disappointment. I think we should keep it at 3.0.
If Chair, I would ask our witnesses to help answer that question.
Mr. Kramer.
Yes. The overwhelming majority of people in the Teach for America program and also the Teaching Fellows programs, as I'm familiar with those also, have GPAs well above 3. There are isolated cases where we see people with GPAs under 3 where we conclude that the rest of the evidence about this person should outweigh the role of the GPA in the decision. And in those cases, we find that having the flexibility to recommend such candidates is in the interest of the school district. So there are always individual stories of people who are extremely compelling and happen to have a low GPA, and there aren't very many of them. That's why the situation was proposed that the Board of Teaching individually look at those cases for under 3.0 GPA.
And Mr. Chair, members, all the other conditions we still continue to apply in that situation.
Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mariani. I really do like this bill, and for Ms. Altschweiger, I am a member of EdMin. I'm a classroom teacher, and I went the traditional route to get my license, but I am so impressed by Teach for America. I have had former students who have turned to that and have been incredibly successful in it. And just 2 years ago, Representative Seifert and I were invited to Teach for America. I don't know, there were like 30 teachers who had just completed their 2 years, I guess, that they work in the program. And we had been invited to come and speak to them and to have them ask us questions and so forth. And the energy in that room and the passion for what they had done was so palpable. And I cannot help but think that going into the inner city, working with minorities where there is a strong achievement gap, there is a niche for this. And I'm always in favor of alternative paths to teaching, and I think that this is a valid one and would certainly endorse
what you're doing, and I truly do appreciate the quality that I witnessed that particular day of the young people who are participating.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more of a comment. I'm speaking in support of this. In fact, I signed on as a co-author yesterday. I've talked to a lot of people in the business community who are my age group that are, you know, thinking about close to retirement and have talked about teaching as a second career. And I don't think they want to go the traditional way to go back and go into the college setting. I think they want this alternative pathway. They have so much, there's so much value to their life experiences and their career expertise, and they would be very helpful, especially in our areas of shortage, especially in the STEM areas. So I just wanted to make those comments.
Representative Downing.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question, too, a little bit about, for the author, on line 1.19, the must ensure that the program serves to enhance any efforts at reducing the achievement gap. And I guess I wouldn't want to preclude my district having the opportunity to avail itself. Was there any consideration to just opening this up more broadly as compared to targeting it very much towards the achievement gap population?
Mr. Chair and members, obviously the issues of race disparities and educational outcomes is a huge challenge for the nation and for our state. We do have two currently waivered organizations who have built, I think both of them have built that in their mission statement. And by the way, later on line 1.9, when we say ensure, it really is, in my mind, is making sure that there's a clear mission within the core mission of the program to address that issue. It's an interesting and challenging question. I would certainly work with you to make sure that we're not fencing out the interests of districts. Where that is not as prevalent an issue, although I have to say, members, it's very difficult nowadays to wander anywhere in this state and not find some pretty substantial and important. The numbers may be different, but the challenges are there in virtually every district, and that is something that, quite frankly, has changed quite drastically since I've become. Come into the legislature. When I first got here, we were primarily talking about urban core, Twin Cities urban core, and maybe regional core issues. But as I go around the state, it's rare that I don't run into a district where they're not struggling to address that issue. But if there's a way to enhance it somehow, I certainly would be willing to work with you and others to make sure we provide the same opportunity.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was ask the author of the bill if he would respond a little to Ms. Altslager's concerns having to do with teacher layoffs and how this will affect. It's my understanding that there's some kind of agreement with the Federation of Teachers in Minneapolis concerning all this, but if you could just fill us in, because it is a concern of mine, and I'm wondering whether or not the notion is that many of the teachers who were laid off did not have the skills somehow that Teach for America could provide, or what the rationale is. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Benson, I wanted to address this. Thanks for creating the opportunity to do that, and I would certainly welcome either Minneapolis or St. Paul School District reps to come forward to help if they need to. But let me just make two very quick points. One is that, in terms of the big picture, we're looking at big demographic shifts in our entire labor market, including in our teacher, professional teacher labor pools. I think the districts know that. That's why a number of them, even prior to these programs, have been working quite feverishly to ensure that they can keep pace with some large-scale withdrawals from the labor market because, we're all getting older here, including our professionals. But two, my understanding, nothing in this, replaces any of our tenure requirements that are worked out between the collective bargaining units and our school districts. And my understanding is that you know, within their license areas that our existing teacher schools have the right, the priority right, to be able to fill those positions. Some of the, a large part of the urgency has to do that we do have shortages with particularly with particular license areas, and I think that's primarily where these school districts are looking for, you know, some additional pathways to be able to fill. But I would certainly turn over to them to help answer anything that I've answered is wrong or incompletely.
Another the interference that we're having is from cell phone, so if you have one of those, please turn it off.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Benson, that was a fabulous question. I just want to assure everybody that we do fill licensed teacher positions based on our contract, which requires that we fill the appropriately licensed area with our existing schools. So, for example, this person would not bump a person that had a license in the area we were doing the job. And I don't have my phone. And I also want to assure the committee that we do everything in our power to try and promote our own candidates within the district. For example, we have a relationship with Oxford right now where we have ed assistants and teacher assistants working in special education to try, you know, to support their efforts in getting a teacher license. We have done teacher of color programs. We've done recruiting. You know what I mean? So we practically stand on our heads and we do everything in our power to try and recruit more highly qualified teachers, particularly teachers of color, to fill these high need areas. But just for special ed alone, we had 56 some type of variance last year with the board. And so we just feel it's really important that we have appropriately trained teachers, particularly in those areas, math, science, special ed, and bilingual.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Graff from Minneapolis Schools. Actually, we view this as a way to win back, that is, working with partnerships that deliver highly qualified, non-traditional teacher candidates as a way to win back market share and increase enrollment. And we are working with our bargaining units to make sure we're not supplanting teachers in those, with our collective, with our, what are we, exclusive bargaining units. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, I'd like to pursue the issue that Dr. Prim raised about the recommendation coming from the mentor. And I have two questions in that regard, or two thoughts. The first is a question, and that's, did, in developing this process, were any other methods for recommendation occur, considered other than the recommendation coming from the mentor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reiner, perhaps a good question for the folks who have helped draft this, but I also am glad you raised this because I wanted to address that issue in closing that I think we need to, I am very open to looking at another way of doing that. I can see the inherent, not necessarily perhaps a conflict, but the inherent difficulty of having a mentor doing also doing the evaluation that, that has this outcome that's desired on the part of the candidate.
Well, what I would ask is that I believe there is a body of research on this, and Dr. Prim may help with this, but because our school district at Mankato has had a long-standing mentor program, we have very explicitly looked at this issue and made a choice to separate those roles because we believe the mentor role is diminished when that mentor has the evaluation authority. So I would say it's very important to look at that ahead of the implementation of this program because I think we run the risk of losing some of the strength of that mentor role.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Beinert, I share that, and I will certainly work with all of the stakeholders involved here to see if there's a better, different way to do this.
Ms. Alcorder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thought it probably good to respond to some of the comments from the Minneapolis and St. Paul lobbyists. I do really appreciate the work that they have done to work with the exclusive representatives and respect their work and the bargaining units as well. I do want to point out, though, that there will be probationary teachers that don't have any continuing contract or tenure rights, and a district can lay off those people right away. Now, that may or may not happen. I'm not sure. But unless it's written into a contract, I don't know if you could assure that with Teach for America is what I'm talking about in terms of the contract. And these are individuals who have gone through the four-year college process to become licensed. So there are situations where you may be laying off probationary teachers. They are the same types of very smart teachers, very excited teachers, just like the Teach for America individuals. And will those people lose their jobs? The other thing is that higher ed is being told to limit the number of applicants or the people that they are letting into the teacher education process in some areas. And if Teach for America or other nonprofits are bringing these people into the profession as well, what happens to that system? So I just wanted to respond to those other comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Kramer?
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to respond to the question on the role of the mentor or mentorship team in recommending evaluation. It has been our experience in other places around the country, two things. First, that we, as I said, maintain a full-time staff of hundreds of instructional coaches who get in classrooms, observe teachers, give advice, review student achievement data, and that those people serve both of these roles, evaluative and support, and that they, as long as they're fully transparent with the people that they're working with and have high integrity and behave appropriately, they actually can do both roles simultaneously pretty well. And they're very highly regarded part of our program. The teachers extraordinarily value both the both of their roles as a coach and a supervisor, in quotes. Second is that I think, you know, changes to the bill from my point of view certainly could be considered, but I think you would want to maintain a focus on having somebody who is truly familiar with the record of improving academic achievement make the recommendation to the board, and then I think you want to make sure that the board is in the final position of ensuring that those recommendations are legitimate and well considered and approving them. I just think that, to me, that's the spirit you want to try to maintain. Is how do we make sure that all of this is focused on whether the teacher turns out to really be good?
Representative Dabney.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just kind of thinking out loud here, and no amendment, but Chair Mariani, do you have a conversation with Representative Downey about kind of what the strategy for expanding this? Did you consider, rather than closing the achievement gap, targeting those schools or districts not making adequate yearly progress? Because I know there's at least several schools in Edina, I think, that would then qualify for participation in the program.
Representative Mariani.
Representative Dabney, the entire state is challenged under the current NCLB AYP framework for lots of reasons, and perhaps it might offer a, you know, another parameter to make this available. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we can hear from Ms. Ballmer on the issue that Representative Reiner raises, because I think it's an important issue. And we have some thoughts. I don't want to offer language at this point, because I think we need to put a little bit more thought, but just want to share, you know, a possible approach here. But if the bill continues, then we'll see if we can work on that.
Ms. Ballmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Reiner, to your question and also to Ms. Prenz, Dr. Prenz's earlier comment, I think it's a good question, and we need to think through carefully what that recommendation piece looks like. One early idea here is just that perhaps we could have some language about collaboration with the higher education partner to expand what's already there. I think we would maybe like to sit down and think through that from a real technical standpoint, but I do think it's a very good point, one that we would want to think through carefully, because right now, all recommendations do come from a higher education partner, unless with the one exception of licensure via portfolio, and so we would want to maintain some consistency there. And, Mr. Chair, if I could briefly address a couple comments made earlier about the intern licenses and the temporary limited licenses.
Go ahead.
Very briefly, we do have a couple mechanisms under the Board of Teaching's authority currently. None of those are what I would call a fit for these programs. So what the Board of Teaching has had to do is waive its own rules to bring Teach for America and the St. Paul Teaching Fellows in. We believe that in the short term, that's okay. Our intent was to waive our rules, gather some data, have some more discussions with stakeholders, discussions like these. But long term, we believe that it is important to have a more straightforward and standardized process in place for programs like this, and that's exactly what this bill would do.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we spent a lot of time in this committee, a great deal of time in this committee this year talking about quality and increasing quality. And, of course, I had a bill that talked about a framework for establishing quality in a systemic way. And we've had other bills and lots of conversation. I think we all want quality for schools. But, you know, where the rubber meets the road is where teachers interface with kids, interface with students. And I think as we look at your bill, Representative Mariani, I want to thank you for this. I think it's good because we're increasing the pool of people that potentially could add quality to our schools. And the key question is who establishes which people are going to add quality to the schools, and it should be the local administrators, the principals, the superintendents, and ultimately the school board making those decisions. And I think as we increase that pool of people with professionals that are outside the teaching realm to begin with. Quite frankly, they might be teaching all along in their business, in their community, whatever they're doing, and now they want to redirect their expertise into the classroom. I think to offer that possibility, not just to those where the achievement gap needs work, which I think would be a tremendous opportunity, not only to those schools who are not reaching AYP, wherever they may be, and quite frankly, that's why we shouldn't engineer where they go. We should just say they should be able to go and let school districts go after them. So I thank you for bringing this forward, and I think as we think about quality, we need to think less about trying to restrict or control the number of teachers in that pool, and more about the quality of the people there so that the school districts themselves can have a larger number of candidates to choose from as they're choosing quality in whatever area they have. And on a personal note, as a father of a teacher who is in her probational period out in western Minnesota, I got to be honest, I'm very gratified that when she's asked back to teach in the last few years, that she's being asked back because they want her and not because they have to take her. And so that's just a personal question. So thank you for the bill and for the opportunity to talk about as we improve quality in schools, where the rubber meets the road, as well as from a large systemic standpoint. I think it's all important.
Mr. Chair, we should probably move ahead. I know we have one other bill which is involve a little bit of discussion.
Yes. And we do have one technical amendment that our technical guru, Representative Obermiller, caught on the A2 amendment. So we're going to ask Representative Mariani that you do bring some sort of a tart or something because he's caught a lot of these things. On line 1.10 on the A2 amendment, it should read paragraph B, clause 1. So we need to take A and change that to B.
Does that qualify as a weird? No. Mr. Chair, whatever motion I need to do to, I guess at this point, because it's amended, I would amend, offer an oral amendment to
great. Representative Mariani moves the change on line 1.10 there. We're working out the A2 amendment to read paragraph B, clause 1. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, I guess in closing, and I appreciate Representative Demmer's comments, but I also want to reassure members that the intent here is to make sure that there is still a rigorous process in place here. This committee spoke very loudly earlier that we're not interested in experimenting with our kids in terms of individuals who are interested, that there be a good vetting process, a good preparatory process that matches up with the reality of individuals who have great aptitudes and skills choosing to enter into the profession and helping our school district meet and our kids meet their needs. And so I just want to reassure that, you know, guiding this is a strong desire to make sure there's a good, rigorous process that we're expecting of these candidates. With that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1340, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation to be referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
The Chair has renewed his motion for House Bill 1340 to be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to the K-12 Education Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Jeffrey, I believe you have a comment to make.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. May I ask, is this the last time we're going to be meeting as a policy group?
I do not believe so.
No.
We'll meet next
time. We will.
All right, thank you very much. That was the only question I had. Thank you.
Representative Newton, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2051 and that it be passed to the K-12 Finance Committee without recommendation.
Representative Newton moves the House File 2051 be recommended to pass and move to the K-12 Finance Division. Representative Newton, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have an amendment, the A1 amendment.
And do you move that amendment?
I move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Faust.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My question is on line 1.3. We're changing the number from 92 to 455. Does that create a significant change in the fiscal note on this bill?
No, it does not.
Thank you.
Representative Newton removes his motion that we approve the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here this morning with Representative Robin Brown, who co-chaired the working group committee with me and very ably moved this bill along as we went through the process. I'd like to briefly go over the highlights of the bill. It first links continuing desegregation funding to student achievement. Its objective is to close the achievement gap. It links the funding to the number of protected students that live in a district and not the total number of students who are members of the school district. It also eliminates desegregation funding for those districts that have less than 15% of protected students. It requires Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and all other school districts to submit a detailed plan to the Department of Education as to how they're going to both close the achievement gap and also further integrate their schools. And currently, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are excluded from that provision. It will also cut by 50% in desegregation funding the districts that don't meet the goals in the approved plans as reviewed by the Department of Education. And finally, it creates a system that is much fairer and more equitable with the goal of looking to close the achievement gap for all students. And with that, I would like to turn over the comments to Representative Brown, who will speak to the approach that we use in developing the bill, and then also how we met the requirements of the legislative auditor.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, thank you so much for hearing the bill. House File 2051 was developed in response to the Legislative Auditor's Report of 2005. And after reading the findings of this report, Representative Newton and I felt that there was a need for change. In preparation for the work that we had to do, you know, we studied the findings of the previous committee work that was done in Representative Dominguez's committee of last session. We read the auditor's report in full. We met with stakeholders on an individual basis, and also we had open committee meetings. We used email to communicate our process and our progress with the stakeholders all along the way. We've also met with the legislative auditor's office and the Department of Education with the idea that we truly wanted to meet the recommendations of the auditor's report. The bill before you addresses the key suggestions that are from the auditor's report, and I just kind of want to walk you through where you can find the different clarifications that we added. If you go to, and I'm going to go rather quickly because I know that you are able to read this yourself as well, but I want to just point out the list of recommendations from the auditor's report I have in front of me. And one of the recommendations was to clarify the purpose, and we did that on line 1.11. We were also to establish criteria and evaluate and be able to evaluate integration plans. And you'll find where we did that on line 2.11 and 4.29. And then I'll just go through this, and then when we're done with our presentation, I think that would be best to take questions then, if that's all right, Mr. Chair. There was a portion that the suggestion was that we withhold integration revenue if districts did not meet the requirements. We did that in lines 3.21 through 3.25. We established criteria in 4.30. We also dealt with the recommendations for the Department of Education to be able to fulfill the responsibilities that they needed to oversee this process. And that comes under, and they need to evaluate districts and review information and provide guidance. And you'll find that, the work done there in 4.7 through 17, 4.28, 4.26 and 7, and that's where the Department of Education's oversight is addressed. We also wanted the department to be able to identify promising integration practices and also to be able to use that information. That's in 4.24 and 2.5. And then we wanted to make sure that voluntary participation has to require approval also from the Department of Ed, and that is in 2.9 through 11, 2.17 through 18, 4.31 and 3.2. And then lastly, we wanted everybody to be under the same authority, and we did that on 1.15, and that would include Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth coming under the same regulations as the other districts. And a lot of these, the verbiage that we came up with was in response to conversations that we had, as I previously mentioned, with the stakeholders. I can say that we tied in many of the recommendations. Not everybody is pleased at this point, but I think that they'll all agree that that we did work with them very closely to bring about their strong concerns.
Mr. Chair, if I might, before we have testifiers come up, I'll also bring the attention of the committee to the sheet that we have that shows its run. That'll show the effect of this bill on the various cities and school districts, rather. And with that, I would like to ask Morgan Brown from the Department of Education and Ms. Judy Randall to come up from the legislative auditor's office.
We have a number of testifiers on this bill, and it is my goal that we would keep the testimony short so that way we can open it up for questions from members. So please keep that in mind as you're coming up to testify. Please state your name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Morgan Brown with the Education Department. On behalf of the department, I want to thank Representative Newton and Representative Brown for approaching the department with some proposals and asking for our initial feedback. We've had several good conversations with them, and we also want, I think as many people here know, when the OLA issued their report in 2005, the commissioner responded saying that she was in favor of all of the recommendations with the OLA report, and we're here 4 years later, and we want that conversation to get going and want to be part of it. And so I also want to thank them for their I think, truly good intent in terms of trying to look at those recommendations and figure out a way to bring them into legislation. I'm sure that's going to engender some pretty energetic conversation starting today, but our perspective is energetic conversation on this is better than no conversation, and so we're happy to see that this kind of is a very good starting point for some really substantive discussions on those OLA recommendations. The department has identified a number of potential concerns and problems with the current language, and we've shared those initially with Representative Newton and Representative Brown, but we're more than willing to continue talking with them and talking with other stakeholders who may express concerns today to see if we can make this bill come into a shape that can engender broader support and see if it can move forward. With that, I'm available to answer any questions regarding the policy impact of the bill, and then also Dr. Melcher from the department is here if there's any questions about the finance provisions in the bill.
Representative Dabney?
A couple questions to Mr. Brown. Where is the department in terms of can you provide us with the criteria that the department has developed for school districts to use to evaluate their integration plans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, to date we have provided some guidance for districts to do essentially self-evaluations of their integration plans. If what was being asked under the revised, essentially the commissioner is being asked to revise the desegregation rule in Section 2 of this bill as part of this, that would be something that we would need to develop through the rulemaking process, I would guess.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney?
How is the department doing on establishing criteria for allowable integration revenue expenditures?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, we have established criteria under what our existing authority is, which does have some limits because what we're essentially doing is reviewing proposed budget expenditures for consistency with the integration plan and consistency with the requirements of the integration revenue statute. That's the primary criteria that we have. We have developed criteria that I'd be happy to share with the committee and have used those for several years now.
Thank you. I'd appreciate seeing the criteria.
Absolutely.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Brown, not Mr. Morgan. I knew I'd get it right by the end of this committee's deadline. I too would like to, if you can make those available, that would be very, very helpful. Perhaps a better question to find it, so very quickly, there are some new expectations built into this language of the department itself. I suspect that part of the things that the department needs to consider has to do with capacity, internal capacity issues. So maybe it's just a simple response in terms of, does this in fact raise some capacity issues current relative to the current department's makeup in providing oversight in this area?
Mr. Chairman, yes, in addition obviously to the rulemaking costs and what's involved there, particularly as I discussed with the authors, paragraph B of subdivision 7, which requires that the department make what would be a pretty complex and sophisticated analysis about the connection between activities funded by integration revenue and impact on academic achievement and achievement gaps. That would certainly be something where we may even need to contract out for help with that kind of analysis.
And just to that point quickly, that would be pretty exciting work. That would be pretty exciting work, I think. And I suspect the department feels the same way. But obviously there are, capacity issues here.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought perhaps when you do runs, I know that we haven't really talked about the run sheet. It was just pointed out that causes some excitement, particularly when there's negatives for some districts. And I did want to point out, because some of the funding currently is being used for outlying districts that they surround a racially a district on an integration plan, and the schools may be surrounding them may be considered, actually districts surrounding them may be considered racially isolated. And so some of the negative numbers here are actually that money is being reflected. And I just wanted to point out that those negatives also mean that they would not have to do the plans that they've been given money to do. So while it may have a negative number for some of those districts, the responsibilities or requirements that go along with those also have been removed from those districts.
Representative Demmer,
that's correct.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, that's correct, and that was the intent.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani?
On this point, I think generally that may be correct, but perhaps not in all circumstances. We'll probably hear from a couple of school districts to that regard. I know my school district, under this particular run, would see about $500,000 drop. It's been that school district's posture that even the current cap amounts don't cover the folks there, their costs. But nonetheless, I think what you have before you is a opening way to begin to talk about these issues, and obviously if this continues forward, you know, we can continue to talk about those fiscal impacts.
Representative Gemma?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, mine is to this point also. If this still happens, Representative Norton kind of jumps in the same issue I was going to bring up. And I know Representative Brown is a legislator who's got rural school districts, and I didn't look at all these school districts. I'm assuming that yours are treated similar to mine. There's a lot of reductions in the rural areas. I'm not sure that's a bad thing. And I would like some of your thoughts and rationalization. I know you've thought this through. I've got my own thoughts and rationalization. I'm not sure it's a bad thing. I think you're doing good work here. But I'd like to hear your thoughts about that, because you must have seen that. You must have thought and processed with the school district you represent, some of those you don't represent that you know a lot about. I'd like to know your thoughts.
Of course, I became interested in this bill last year when it was going through the subcommittee. And in my area, in my particular area, my schools are not going to be affected by the language in this bill. But there are schools that have a higher population of protected students. Albert Lee has 20%, but it doesn't come under some of these guidelines that would allow it to be eligible for this funding. I would love to see the money that is being distributed right now come to Albert Lee area, because we certainly could use it for the purposes that are required in this language. I think overall my thought with being heavily involved in this bill was that we wanted to get an overall better sense of accountability, and if that means that some districts may not receive dollars that they had before based on that accountability, you know, that's the way it is, and I do very much sympathize with those that may be losing some funding, but I think that we need to get a framework that is more consistent, and there's accountability involved with that as well.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first, I agree with you, and quite frankly, I think anecdotally, and I'm going to be looking for some information from my district as well as others, anecdotally, I think that, as Representative Norton suggested, not only would they be relieved of some burden and some work here, and quite frankly, I think there's also a local levy portion to this, if I don't misunderstand, that they actually may not have to levy that also to do this. I'll throw a caveat in there, and something I thought about with the bill as I read through the, and we had a discussion before, the number of 15% is, I don't know where it came from. I always look at those numbers and think, I wonder how arbitrary that really is. The caveat that maybe there be an opportunity for school districts who, for whatever reason, feel that even though they don't meet that 15% threshold, while I wouldn't want to force them to have to do that, and one of the criticisms I've had of integration revenue, we have had four school districts that have to do a plan, even if they don't think it's necessary locally. On the other hand, we might have some that think it's necessary that don't meet the threshold, might open up a pathway for them to be able to apply for a waiver of the 15% for good cause and something. And I know we got to be careful about the funding and that sort of thing, which we'll talk later. But that might be a thought, too, is to say, well, if you don't meet 15%, there's another opportunity. If you really believe it's necessary for you to put a plan in place, that you can do that.
Representative Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Demmer, I agree with what you've just said. I think that was part of what we talked about. We had these conversations about opening this so that those who would voluntarily involved would be under the same plan. Those details need to be worked out still, and as I'm sure that we're going to find out as the conversation continues today, that there's going to be room for movement, and we're totally willing to have that discussion. I think that, and I don't want to speak for Representative Newton, but I'm in agreement, especially, like I said, in some of the rural areas where our concentrations are quite a bit higher and may not be affected directly by this bill at this point. I think that if someone is willing to participate under the rules and create a plan, that we need to have room for them.
Ms. Members, I think we're going to move forward with some of the testimony, and then we'll come back to questions. Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Judy Randall with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm mostly here to take questions and serve as a resource and just say that we appreciate that Representatives Newton and Brown are looking at the report. As Mr. Brown stated, we released the report in fall of 2005, and it gets discussed a lot, I think. But we are eager to see our recommendations, or happy to see our recommendations being considered. And I think I'm mostly here just as a resource to take questions if members have them. Thank you.
Ms. Graham. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Teresa Graham. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker and a school social worker, too. I have over 30 years of experience in my professional field, including 16 years working directly in Minnesota schools, both in direct service capacities and administrative capacities. I'm not a paid lobbyist, but I am very interested in this issue, have followed it through the years, and have recently completed a research project, which I emailed to all of the members today, a summary of that project, and also a spreadsheet of all the 114 school districts that are currently receiving integration revenue with their current budget for 2009, and also the items that they're spending their integration revenue on. I hope that you all receive that, because it does give you kind of a total picture of what's happening now, and it's kind of an expansion on what the Legislative Auditor's Office did back in 2005. I believe they looked at a sampling of 20 school districts. I looked at every single file in the Minnesota Department of Education in December and January of this year, so they get a real good feeling for how this money is being spent. First of all, I would like to say Representative Newton and Representative Brown have done just a tremendous job of putting this bill together and addressing a lot of the issues and a lot of the constituencies involved, and I applaud them for doing so. There's just a couple of comments I'd like to make to expand on some of my research today that I think it's important for you as a policy committee to address. One of them has to do with the whole definition of integration and the definition of protected students. This is the one thing that everyone seems reluctant to address, and I really hope you have some discussion about that, because that was one of the recommendations of the Legislative Auditor's Office. And it repeatedly came up in the research that school districts are very confused about what they're supposed to be doing with this money, and so they pretty much do whatever they want. There's been very limited oversight by the Minnesota Department of Education of a very understaffed in this area, and it's not been a priority for them at all. I really like the tenets of this bill that address the accountability issues, that address some of the specifics of how the integration revenue will be evaluated. There were very few evaluations in any of those files. I'd like to give a shout out to some of the rural collaboratives, because actually some of their plans were some of the best plans, and one of the few evaluations was from the Medelia Collaboration Integration Collaborative. While those collaboratives maybe have fewer numbers than they do in the urban areas, they actually did really accept some of the challenges that they have with geographic distance and differentials in their areas. So those are the really good pieces about this. We really need some accountability for this money, and we need it to be tied to the achievement gap and show some outcomes. So those are really tremendous things. The one thing about that I would urge you as a policy committee to discuss is the whole area of protected students. House File 2051 refers to the definition of protected students in the Minnesota Rule 3535.0110. And that definition specifically addresses protected students as African / Black Americans, Chicano / Latino Americans, Asian / Pacific Americans, and American Indian / Alaskan Native as the categories. One of the things that came up in my review and my research was that a lot of districts are using some of this money for their English language learners. And I spoke yesterday with Dr. Meltzer, I believe is here, from the Minnesota Department of Education, to clarify who is identified as protected students in this information that we were given by the Department of Education and also the run that's been done today for you about the projections. And I do think it's a little confusing because I couldn't find a written policy on it. Dr. Melcher said that he assumes that some of the children are qualified in more than one area. For example, sometimes the funds that go for free and reduced lunch also go for children of color and also go for English language learner students. So a child can receive funds in more than one category, as you know. But there is a lot of confusion about, and I think there's going to continue to be this confusion unless this is identified by either in statute or in rule as to who you're reporting, because there will be over-reporting or under-reporting, especially when you have a cutoff of 15% as qualifying for revenue. So that might be an area that you might want to just flesh out a little bit in terms of the policy issue. So I thank you for the opportunity to address you. I really encourage you to pass this legislation. It's been 4 years, and the situation, as you could tell from my summary and research, has deteriorated considerably. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. And thank you for the shout-out. That's the first time in 3 months that I've heard that in a committee hearing. So, Ms. Gilbert. Is she... Mr. Grappel.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Grappel. I'm not Mary Gilbert. I represent the Minneapolis Public Schools. I'd like to, Ms. Gilbert had to run out and is doing one other little piece of business. I texted her. I'm sure she's on her way back. I'd like to thank Mr. Chair and members, thank the authors, Representative Newton and Representative Brown, for their work on this bill, and the chairs who appointed them to the work. So, very briefly, I'm trying to read my own notes here. I appreciate the work on the bill on the definition of the rule, and with the adoption of the amendment, some clarification as to how that paragraph C works. But I want to go right to page 2. Basically, the overall, I think the Minneapolis is one of the districts that has never been confused about what integration revenue is for and what its uses are. I think when we talk about accountability for use of the revenue, and I really appreciate that adding achievement gap, addressing the achievement gap back into the rule. I think when we get to page 2, actually it's page 3, the accountability for not making adequate or now amended to be sufficient progress. I think it's hard to out NCLB, NCLB. I think NCLB is the piece that holds us accountable for closing the achievement gap. And I just want to point out kind of a law of unintended consequences in terms of if we keep this language as it is, and we're working with collaborative partners to either open enroll through Choices Yours or through our WEMAP programs to take students from Minneapolis, which helps us integrate, that they're actually taking a risk of losing their integration funding if they have trouble, which they're accepting the challenge to work with students and help close that achievement gap. So I would recommend that this section, instead of trying to out NCLB, I would recommend focus this on how are you doing on the heavy lift of integrating metropolitan-wide our district. That's the issue for Minneapolis, is that we have a limited ability with 70% students of color, 30% white, to integrate within our own boundaries. So we need to have those partnerships, and we're working to hold ourselves accountable within those partnerships. This language, as it's drafted, I think, puts some of those partnerships at risk. So I would encourage the accountability piece to be focused on how are you doing helping with the integration lift. And I hope that's clear when I say that, on helping us do that work of integration and not increase the risk of doing that. I'm not going to speak to the computer run at all, but I just want to point out one option for the committee and for the legislature is to return to how we used to fund integration, which was grants based on what you do. Show us your plan, we'll fund the plan. That's how the first three grants Representative Denver, that's how the 15% first came in. It was Minneapolis, when it was sued, had 15% students of color. And we were segregating intent. Well, I actually can't speak authoritatively on whether it was de jure or de facto, but anyway, it was ruled we were segregating within that threshold. So another issue is, by choosing that 15% threshold, you would not have any consequence for a district with 14%, but with segregating within that. You may want to look at that, and I'm not sure if the authors considered that, but you could have a racially isolated site in a school with fewer than 15%. But back to the whether you want to do formula or not, you could do program grants. Approve. I think the real accountability measure you have and is in this bill is the approval of everybody's plan. So you may want to just stick with that as a hammer. Approval of the plan, working with the district on whether they're investing resources to improve integration. I want to just put a plug in that I think in this world today, integration, we're going to need more than relying on public education to achieve true integration. You're going to have to look at low-income housing tax credits. You're going to have to look at areas beyond. That's not compassed in this bill, but I just feel responsible to say that. I would appreciate more interim work and maybe as inclusive and as responsive as the authors have been, which I appreciate, a broader, more diverse set of eyes looking at how we define integration. And I think that's it. I'd like to thank the authors for the work on the bill and the responsiveness to our concerns in the process. And I'd be happy to turn it sit or stand for questions or turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you. Can we hear from Ms. Gilbert as well?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. I just want to echo what Jim said. We have had a lot of input into the process, and the draft did include some of the suggested changes we had, particularly as it related to, there were two major factors that we had concerns. One is to ensure that whatever way we move forward, that we could grandfather in or acknowledge that we had an existing integration program within the St. Paul District right now, and that we wanted to keep the program intact, and that the expenditures related to that program would continue to be eligible expenditures under whatever new, you know, revenue formula that you came up with. And I do believe that the bill does allow for that. It either says, you know, you can spend the money on either achievement gap, or you can spend it on programs that provide more interracial contact. And so so they did address that concern, and then the other particularly was that the money had to be spent initially in the initial draft on just isolated schools, which would have been three schools in our district, you know. And again, the whole point for us is to try and provide some integration opportunities across the district and have choice based on what parents and families choose. So I do really appreciate that they moved in that direction. One of the other things we talked about in the subcommittee was having a formula that was heavily weighted or totally weighted on minority class students. And you know, frankly, in most cases, that would help us. But it is a bit of an incentive to not actively integrate because you get more money based on your protected class students. And we were happy too that, you know, what we said is just because it works in St. Paul doesn't mean that you should have the same program in every other district. So I believe that's why the authors allowed for achievement gap as another alternative use. The dilemma it causes for us in St. Paul is that if a district had to choose between taking all of its money and just doing achievement gap or taking its money and doing integrated activities with our district, given the economy, they'd be in a really tough position. I mean, a lot of the boards in their very early work with us, frankly, took a lot of flack. And Representative Growling can speak to that when she was on the Rose Bowl board, how difficult it was to get communities to actually consider relationships with urban districts. There was a lot of, you know, either loud or soft bigotry around what things that we were doing initially when we moved towards some of our metro-wide initiatives. So the other concern we have, and that's just a constant concern related to, we just don't want to be blowing in the political wind of whatever commissioner might be up there. We have a good relationship with the department. We've had some commissioners who wanted to have a particular model in place. You know, and so we also want to make sure that how we move forward, that we have the ability to have approval, you know, a framework that would allow the local school district to develop what kind of plan is appropriate for its district and not to be kind of caught in the political wind. You know, for example, if a new commissioner said, no, we don't want you to do your own program, we want everybody to go, choice is yours. Or, you know what I mean, that would just be an example, you know, of how, based on kind of approval and how you spend your money and how you evaluate the program, if you have a particular plan in mind that you want a district to do and you don't necessarily agree that that's best for your community, you might kind of be caught in the process about whether or not you would continue to get your revenue, you know, and whether your program would be approved. So, I think
you
probably said everything. I was over talking to Linda Bergman about the bill. So.
No problem. Mr. Philbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ron Philbert. I'm with the Duluth School District, and a lot of what I was going to say has been said already. I shouldn't have told Jim what I was going to say before the meeting. But I'd also like to thank Representative Brown and Representative Newton for the work that they've done. They've put in a lot of hard work and real effort into coming up with the recommendations and have been inclusive, and we appreciate that. We appreciate the ability to be able to have some input. If I was going to summarize it in one sentence, I don't think that, and it's such a complicated subject that no one can be blamed by this, but I don't think that the policy is ready yet to determine the revenue distribution. I think it's such a complicated issue, there are so many different variations of the plans out there right now that it'd be really difficult, to take a look at what's being offered and come out with a model based on that sole experience. I think all school districts should be working on closing the achievement gap. I know we've been doing it, and I know all the other districts that you've heard from have been doing it, and we're having some success. I just don't think that closing the achievement gap is necessarily a function of the integration program. We all said that we thought that could be a very worthwhile goal. And if it was up to the legislature to include that as a specific goal of integration, I don't have a problem with that. I was a little concerned that it was almost going to become the exclusive goal of integration. I noticed that in the amendment, one of my concerns was addressed on page 2, line 2, deleting or and inserting and, because it would have given districts the entire choice of either just closing the achievement gap or making increased opportunities and sustained opportunities for interracial contact, which is as close as we come to the original integration goals that were set out years ago when actually Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth were required to get into enter an integration plan. Obviously, with the revenue formula, I also agree that, you know, that a program-based funding for approved grants by the department for school district integration funding are probably the preferred way to go. I think we could argue that program-based funding, if there was someone that could figure it out, would be the way to go for all school districts in a school formula, but that's another subject. The fact that we did put together plans that we had to do back when they were either court ordered or ordered by the commissioner to either integrate our schools or to face loss of state aid. Not just there was no new aid at the time. There was simply a threat to take away state aid from the general fund if we didn't comply was important, and that effort is what made us come up with what we thought were plans that would work and it was a sincere effort and it was a lot of work, and we're very proud of our communities and communities of color that have gotten together and worked together on the the Integration Advisory Group in Duluth. They've been in existence for many years, and they've done a lot of work and have proved as a model, actually, for other districts as they enter the arena of integration, and have had lots of visits from other school districts to come up and see what we've done. So when it was artificially converted to a per pupil basis a few years ago from the program-based funding that Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth originally had, I understand the importance of doing that in terms of trying to come up with a funding mechanism to deal with a lot of new districts that were suddenly coming on board. But it's not necessarily a method that can bring a fair revenue amount to each district trying to deal with that issue. And I was going to say more, but I think I've been running on a little long, so I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Silberg. Representative Guthrie has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for I have to leave for in district meeting right now, but I just wanted to thank both Representative Newton and Brown. We in my district were all for reform, we're all for accountability and all of those kinds of things. Although my district in this scenario is at risk of losing $1 million, and this this state of financial crisis that we're in, this could be quite a shock to them in this year. But I think what we're talking about, and I'm not saying that we're not going to be supportive of this issue, is that it seems like we still have a lot of things to take a look at. And there are even some ideas that are surfacing on the definition of integration, protected students. Even though you make it voluntary, our district is not going to back off on the kinds of things that we've been doing. Certainly, we're going to continue to provide those kinds of services. And I think there's a lot of good ideas today. I would like to make a suggestion to the committee that the Senate is currently has seen this bill as well, and it's my understanding, although I know that we don't want to mirror the Senate that a few times, that they've formed a subcommittee to study integration funding, because it seems like it's unearthed a lot of really good questions that have come up today, and will probably not address this issue in this session. And I would like to make a strong suggestion that we do that because of the severe swings in funding for some of the areas throughout the state, and really do it right and do it at a time when it doesn't catch them off guard at this time. Thank you very much.
Representative Greiling and then Representative Fowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also have to leave, and I wish I didn't. This is what I most wanted to hear today, but we have a fiscal chairs meeting, and this is not the year to be missing the fiscal chairs meeting. You never know what would be happening to us, all of us, if I was not there. But I just want to say, and that segues into it very nicely with Representative Depke's comment, this, like the innovation revenue from last night, is not intended for this year. This Representative Brown and Representative Newton are leading a work group for our K-12 Education Finance Committee, which is where this bill came from, and there are other members on the committee that they may have listed at the beginning. We are intending to put this into the new Minnesota miracle. So, you know, we can't have winners and losers with new funding formulas like we would with a lot of the new funding formulas in the new Minnesota miracle. This is intended to be in there so it can be phased in gradually, and then there's enough new money so that the losers will not have a loss as the bill is phased in. That's what all the new formulas do. So we have time to work on it. It's in policy first, because just like the innovation revenue, there are policy considerations with the language parts of the bill, but it will be the finance committee that will be dealing with the finance parts, and so hopefully this committee can give some good instruction on the policy parts, because we do intend to enact those this year. There have been people that have been interested in another legislative auditor study on the integration districts where there are also problems, but the auditor's answer was, no, you haven't acted on this one yet. It's been sitting out there since 2005. That was the legislators on the audit commission, I should clarify, that came to that determination. Some are still trying to encourage another study that could include those districts, but that is certainly not going to happen if we don't take any action this year, at least on the policy parts. And so that is what I hope this committee can give good recommendations as that I can hear about later, and then we can go forward with those and then continue to work on the finance parts during the interim, but the phase-in will take care of the winners and losers part, so we shouldn't get hung up on that. Thank you.
Representative Faust, did you have a...
No.
Okay. I'd like to call down Dan Jett, Keith Lester, and Sharon Peters-Hardin, if they would like to come down and offer some testimony as well. To our testifiers, welcome. Please limit your testimony to new information that would be relevant to us, and then if you would be willing to stand for questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Jett, you can begin. State your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Dr. Daniel Jett. I'm superintendent of the West Metro Education Program, also known as WEMEP. And although I'm one person, I'm speaking for three today. I'm speaking to Dr. Carl Walston, who is the superintendent of the East Metro Integration District, who's in the audience, and the superintendent of the Northwest Suburban Integration District, Martha Moore, who's also in the audience. We thought one speaker would conserve some of your time. If I could do just a couple things, first I would also like to express appreciation to Representative Brown and Newton for involving our integration district in their conversation right from the very beginning. They asked some very pointed questions. We've tried to provide candid answers, and it's been just a very healthy dialogue, we believe. First and foremost, we would respectfully suggest that the bill, as it stands, puts the cart just a bit before the horse, and some folks have just spoken to that issue about getting the policy issue real clear first before the funding then follows it. And that would really be our perspective. We think the legislature has an opportunity to do more than fix the DSEG rule or integration revenue program. We think the legislature has an opportunity to really rise up and make Minnesota a star in leading the way to deal with the issues of integration in our community. And we're talking about integration with a capital I, the big integration of our communities. The integration revenue proposal would need to make clear and unambiguous a statement about the state of Minnesota's compelling interest in having well-integrated and equitable public schools as a benefit to all students and to the entire community, and then to provide the means for that to take place. We recommend that the desegregation rule be thoroughly reviewed and revised where necessary before a funding scheme with rules and regulations and evaluation components be developed. And we stand ready to assist in that effort and hope that if there is a study committee going forward that we and our member districts could be part of that activity. We would like to briefly offer that on the bill itself. We'd like to see incentives for districts to collaborate rather than each district getting their money and doing their thing. We have evidence in our three integration districts that we can leverage dollars in a more successful way than each individual district doing that, not exclusively, but in combination with their efforts in their own local districts. And then, as has been mentioned, we have in each of our three integration districts a number of voluntary districts that are just committed to the work, as Representative Deputy, just matter of fact, her district is one, and others, Stillwater and so forth, that are just tremendously committed to this work, are very active and highly successful in it. So we would encourage including those volunteer districts as well. I'll take questions.
Mr. Lester.
Yes, sir. My name is Keith Lester, Superintendent of Brooklyn Center Schools, and this is a meeting I actually came here for. I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for you to hear me. I'll take this a little bit different tack because you've heard a lot of the arguments, and I don't think I disagree with any of them. I would say that my gratitude for Representatives Newton and Brown is, yes, for getting input and participation, but I think also for having the courage to stand up and take a look at this. You know, that report came out 4 years ago, and they're putting it on the table and taking, I'm sure, some risks, because I happen to know at least one of them loses money in a home district there in this particular plan. Brooklyn Center benefits from it, obviously, and we actually even have a bill in saying that there are three school districts that look like Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we feel maybe should be funded that way. I would never walk into any kind of a situation saying I want to take money away from someone else. So that being said, I like to think I'm innovative, and I think we need to sit down and talk about, you need to sit down, excuse me, to talk about how to do this. But let me just throw out a couple of things. First of all, I support that it's closing the achievement gap, and it's for increased interracial context. I don't know how you can separate the two, because if we lose a whole bunch of kids. In fact, there was an argument that made that other districts could be challenged too. Well, we have it now. We're living with it today, and so if we lose a number of kids, that isn't going to necessarily make anything better in closing the achievement gap for us. Most of you have heard the data, my mantra about our demographics and so on. But I just want to highlight, the report came out 4 years ago, said it was broken. We were even mentioned. I feel, I don't want to say I feel honored, but we've been mentioned a lot, and I'm not going to dwell on that. But if using raw numbers, and I just took 1650, our enrollment is about 1750, and really you probably should have used that number, but if not using weighted students, if we would, 4 years ago, if something would have changed, Brooklyn Center would have received $2,085,600 more in integration revenue over those 4 years. Now, this struck me as interesting because that happens to be almost exactly the amount that we're in statutory operating debt. Now, I'm not saying there's a direct correlation, because I understand integration money needs to be used for specific things, but I'd say that if the $2 million over that period of time would have come to Brooklyn Center, we would not have to cut as many teachers and larger class sizes. We don't have any librarians, and we could have librarians in our school, and I think you could make a case for closing the achievement gap with having professionals that can deal with that. We wouldn't have had to cut staff, support staff and programs. We might not be in SOD, not that I want to count on integration money to get us out of SOD, and we might be showing higher scores because we would have had more people and more opportunity for our kids. My big concern, what I think is not different than anything you've heard, but something that I want to say out loud, my fear is that if we continue to talk about what should happen in order to close the achievement gap and not take real action now, another year is going to go by. So I think a subcommittee is a great idea, but how about the children that are in school today, and how long is it going to take for us to get to them? I know you all care about kids, but I'm asking you to put a face on them. It's not just the districts, it's not just the reports, it's not just the courts, it's not just the legislature. I have 1,750 of the greatest kids in the world that deserve an equal opportunity, and I think we should get going on it. For some districts, waiting a bit to fix the problem could work. I believe Brooklyn Center children have been waiting long enough. I hope you'll find a way to work together with the Department of Ed and all these other groups to help our children and all the children like them who need change now and not sometime in the future.
Thank you. Ms. Peters-Hardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I would also like to thank Representatives Newton and Brown for taking the courage to propose this bill for so much open discussion. I am here representing Osceola Area Schools District 279, and as many of you know, we're the fifth largest district in the state, and we are the third most diverse. 44% of our students are students of color, and we have currently 10 racially segregated schools. Now, that segregation is due to a number of things. It's socioeconomic, it's housing patterns, and it's just simply the geographic region of our school district. Part of our district covers Brooklyn Center as well as Brooklyn Park, and those communities have high concentrations of populations of color. So I guess what you want to hear, I won't repeat what much of it has been said already today, but I will say that in our district, we also support moving forward with looking at the statute that governs integration aid as well as the rule. We would like to see a connection to student progress, of course, but we do believe that some of the language about student achievement closing the achievement gap is confusing in light of Nickel B. But we believe that all programming and all funding dollars should be tied to student progress, and also establishing criteria for evaluation of these programs at the end of 3 years, I believe, is critical. We believe it needs to be rigorous so that we can connect those dollars to student progress. And the other thing that I would also like to say is that as the committee moves forward reviewing this, that we would like to have our school districts, who are faced with the challenges,
of providing integrated learning opportunities, as well as looking at how do we integrate our schools with an opportunity to be involved with that conversation. We're a member of the Northwest Suburban Integration School Collaborative, and we work with them in terms of cross-district, inter-district integration, but with 10 racially isolated schools in our district, we have a moral responsibility to provide integrated learning environments for our students, and we're very much interested in seeing this work advance and bring clarity to the process and to the issues.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Downey.
I'll pass. There's been lots of discussion on the questions I have.
Thank you. Representative Biner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This comment slash question is sort of more for the authors, but I have some really serious concerns about the accountability pieces of this bill, and you've already heard some of those raised by Jim Graswald and Morgan Brown. Morgan Brown noted the difficulty the department might have in meeting the requirements you raised. And what I would say is you use the phrase adequate progress. I don't believe you can use that without definition. I think, really there's a need for some consultation and alignment with the overall accountability plan of the state and what you're talking about here, and caution in your use of language. In 418, you say the department shall determine whether the school district integration plans have reduced the achievement gap. That's a very loaded phrase to say whether the school district integration plans have reduced the achievement gap. But you're asking for a causal relationship. You're going to have to define some measures. You're going to have some research base for whether those measures are directly connected to, especially if you're attaching funding to these measures. So, and what I would say is there's a whole body of research on this. And I think if you haven't already visited with people like the Minnesota Assessment Group, if you don't know about the Minnesota Assessment Group, it's 80 experts in the state who probably have the highest brain power on issues of accountability and assessment that you can tap into, to ask about what types of correlations or measures that are already in existence you might use to begin to address the accountability. I'm not saying don't ask for measures. We need to do that. But we should be sure we're asking for the right measures and not be too quick to use language that can't be translated into some more specific data-driven structures.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too have some concerns with this bill. One of the issues that I've always had is the difference in funding. If you have a child that's attending school in Minneapolis and then they transfer or they move to Brooklyn Center, all of a sudden it costs the state less money and the school gets less money than Minneapolis got for the same child. And then when they move to Mora a year later, then they get even less again. And so that's one of the issues that I have with that, and you don't need to address that. My question actually is for Superintendent Lester. Because you kind of addressed this issue as far as the cost of one of the things that limits how much money a school district may get. There are three things, and one of them is the actual cost of implementing the plan. Would it be fair to say that given the fact that you can use the part of the plan is reducing the achievement gap, would it be fair to say that that will never limit how much money a school gets?
Mr. Chair. Representative Falls, probably not. I guess my point with this would be that, if we take our current plan, it's sufficient for the plan. The money we have is sufficient for the plan, but it's not sufficient to do the job that it's supposed to do.
Okay. Representative Falls, follow?
No, I'm good.
All right. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to touch on a couple of things. Representative Biner raised some of the concerns that I have around the accountability measures, and I want to go to a slightly different provision there, and that is, I think it's 4.16, and there may be some other places where we try to drill down to the school site level on accountability, and my concern there is we may be recreating the exact same problem we currently have with No Child Left Behind, where here now we measure one group of third graders, and then the next year we measure a different group of third graders, and we say, aha, we know how the school is doing. And here we'd be setting up a system where we're essentially doing the same thing. We'd measure a site's achievement gap one year, we'd measure it another year with a different set of students, and we'd say, aha, we know how they're doing. Rather than more of a growth model, as Representative Briner has done. We've talked in other settings in the work group about issues of, and it's been touched on today, changes in housing patterns. I've talked about some of the schools in Minneapolis, Roosevelt High School, that this is going back maybe a decade or a little bit more, but with immigration, suddenly had hundreds of Somali students. And if you compared Washburn Year A to Washburn Year D, you would get very different educational outcomes, but if you didn't look at the changing demographics and a sudden influx of English language learners there, you would say, oh, it's a terrible school and it's failing. And so the measures need to be sensitive to issues outside of the school of immigration, housing patterns, economic experience, and so on. Moving down, and I'll just, again, this is just me rattling on. 5.1, determining whether school district has engaged in intentional segregation, a very worthy discussion. I mean, we hear anecdotally of school districts carving attendance boundaries for elementary schools such that they isolate based either on racial or economic grounds. I think having the department determine that is maybe even scarier to the department than it is to me, because I think that's a very loaded measure to ask them to arrive at. And then lastly, 5.4, I'm not sure it's the department that should be defining the achievement gap. Perhaps it is. And maybe it's us, maybe it's them. I'm not sure, but I would at least would like to see more conversation around that. Thank you for the time.
Representative Peterson.
This discussion is very interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Representative Dabney's comments triggered a piece that I'm concerned about also, and that's the concept, even in our district, which has one of those districts that has the high ratios, the idea of community schools and the idea that many of these communities want to stay together, and it's not really racial isolation in the sense that the communities themselves want to be together and it may result in an racially isolated school. And I know there have been attempts in both Osceola and Robbinsdale to try to integrate the schools, but it's not an easy task. And so I hope that there's some consideration given also to other factors other than just integration. And I see that, you know, on the one hand, we're urging all the integration, and then I look at the all of the charter schools, which are becoming more racially isolated. And so we seem to always have kind of a dichotomy of purposes going on here. So anyway, just some comments.
Representative Brown or Representative Newton, any other comments on behalf of the bill?
This has been a very interesting journey, and you've all given us a lot of food for thought. And as Representative Greiling was saying, Mr. Chair, this is we're providing a policy framework, and we're hoping to get this developed, and it's going to be an ongoing thing. The numbers can be plugged in later, I think, but the important thing is that we look at integration revenue and how we're integrating our communities of color into the larger community, and how we do close that achievement gap. So those are our main objectives. And I know that Representative Brown and I have both taken a lot of notes, and you probably see something a little different when it gets to K-12 finance.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair,
And I want to thank the committee for the questions that they had and the stakeholders who were willing to give us feedback all along the way and today as well. Representative Newton said, we've been taking notes. I think that we are further along in the process than we were at the beginning of this meeting, and we really appreciate that. I think our intent is to take all the comments into consideration. Like I said, we wrote some good notes on this, but we also would like to be able to, with this bill, put districts under the same guidelines and make the system more accountable. We're willing to continue to work as we go along with this bill as it processes through committee, and would really appreciate your support on it.
Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? See no one else. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Brown and Representative Newton. I want to thank you also for the tough assignment. This is a tough assignment. I have to say I'm worried. I think all of us absolutely need to approach this area very carefully. As you all know, there were recent, within the last 2 years, U.S. Supreme Court rulings that have perhaps some bearing on any changes that we may lift up to the surface in this state in regards to these efforts. I think we need to tread very carefully here. I am convinced that waiting too long to respond to legislative auditors' good work is not good practice on our part. We often avail ourselves of their wisdom and their guidance. We certainly did that earlier this year in regards to proposals to reform charter school oversight legislation. I think it's important that we move forward. I think they've given us a really helpful frame. I don't think anyone in the room here is arguing that we shouldn't attempt to modernize, modernize our approach to our integration efforts in our state. And of course, that has a strong bearing on the use of integration revenue. A little bit, perhaps not unique, but a little bit challenging in this whole area is that we've got some strong guidance that exists both in rule and in statute here. And there are some important political sensitivities historically on why that's the case. And so I think it is important that we tread carefully, but at the same time, I want us to keep treading. We kind of went through an iteration of this a couple of years ago, and then it just sort of, fizzled out. And I think Superintendent Lester's testimony was, quite poignant in that regard. With that, I want to encourage that this committee not recommend passage of the bill, and I would request that the authors change their motion to move the bill forward without recommendation, so that we can continue to vet this out carefully in K-12. I would then challenge all of us to not simply let that sit there as it's currently written, but to continue to work in response to a number of difficult issues. And if we can't address enough of those, then I will certainly work to do no harm as opposed to experiment with what I think is important but also very difficult policy work before us. So, Representative Newton, I would respectfully ask that change in your motion.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Mariani and Mr. Chair. Actually, that was my motion, that we pass it on without recommendation. And just one final comment. I think that there's a tendency, especially among those of us who are white folks, to tiptoe around the issue of race. And we have to address this issue and have to make sure that we're taking into account the changing nature of our communities, and that we address this issue face on. So thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Newton recommends that House File 2051 be not recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
No.
right?
There is a way to word it.
I know, I'm just like, how do we word this now?
We rarely do it.
Recommended to pass on to the Committee on Finance. With a recommended re-referral to K-12 Finance, but without further recommendation.
Well,
that's a mouthful.
That doesn't quite do it, I don't think. That's
okay.
Important. Is it? Is that how it's... Oh, that's our standard language? Well, Mr. Chair, again, you know, for the record, the intent here is that this body is not... it wants to move the bill forward. The language here is not, the recommended language. We want to keep this thing moving forward because of our deadline. So, just for the record.
So with that motion, and it's a mouthful, I would ask that we take that to a vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you all.
And I believe we stand adjourned.